Okay, I'm glad you're here, Brian. In my ongoing
Happy New Year!
Who did that second one?
That was me.
Oh,
just had to put that in there.
Hey, Bob, I'm here too.
You are here? You're gonna
of course I'm here. Who's been playing the music?
Yeah, Greg's going to go through a paradigm shift this year. It's going to be a good year for Greg. You'll catch up.
That's what catch happens. It's going to be a good year for me.
Yeah, you know, somebody sent me, no, it was R. Cam, the guy who thinks I'm incredible, has some clout out there in the Twitter world. He posted for people to know about me, my part one or something of the 100th birthday. And so I started looking at it. It's pretty interesting because I never looked at it again. So there are people there that were being shown that I didn't see what they looked like because I wasn't looking at that point for some reason and missed it. But there's funny pictures of Greg. And Greg looked a bit different back then. That's 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So one person I hadn't seen was Trevor, the black guy in England, Jamaican or something, who, if you remember on the chat line for years, accused us all. He was a nice guy at first, and all of a sudden he accused us of being racist. And it really seemed to mean it. And he would drop off and quit every now and then come back. And so I got to see what he looked like for the first time, you know. It was very funny, the whole interaction. He was calling out Greg and Brian and Ion as extreme racist stuff. But it was all done in joking because we could see him. And video is a cool medium, so he couldn't be hot like he could on radio. But that was last night. The next day, I get an email. First time I really, well, maybe 5, 10 years ago, I used to get emails from Trevor. Unfucking believable. How's that for timing? I haven't talked to Trevor
since
2 years ago, but never emailed in years because he got so mad at me. He wouldn't, he seemed to be tended at least that he was, meant it that we were racist. So I years ago called him up and started talking to him, and he was all nice and calm and passive, and I started yelling at him for fucking having no guts to confront me like he does in his emails at the chat line. And that was funny. He just got him laughing. That's the last time I probably talked to him. And here he showed, I evoked him. I was looking at him last night, saw what he looked like, and said, "Happy year. Hi, Bob. Hope that you are well. I've just moved once again. Please keep in touch. Love as always, Trevor/T. We called him T. Remember that? He used to be T in the chat line. So that's kind of cute. So I think I'll call him up when I get a chance and renew our homosexual relationship and see how that goes.
Why don't you call him now?
No. We got things to do.
I think you know what I'm going to do just for the hell of it? I'm just going to go ahead and say that because it's not illegal or anything, I'm just going to say I'm a racist. I'm just going to cover it off right now.
Yeah, but everybody's a racist.
Yeah.
How do you be yourself?
Yeah, I'm just going to cover it off. So I don't want anybody saying, you're a racist. I've already said that. You're not telling me anything new.
Yeah, but listen to this, Greg. It's not a problem to be a racist. The one who came up with the original means of bypassing the issue was Beefheart. Cover of Rolling Stone, May 14th, 1970. What did he say? I've said it a million times. I'm not here. I only hang around for my friends. And then his particular comment on racism was, we're all colored. Or we wouldn't be able to see anybody. That was his follow-up. But, you know, if you say you're not here, they can't start describing you based on their illusion, their illusion that you are here. You find that funny, Brian? You fucking...
Yeah, they can't, yeah, they can't start describing you. I like that.
Yeah. Like, I'm not even here, buddy. If everybody's not here in the trip body, you can't see anybody. Yeah, no, that's not true. You can if you allow yourself to be seen.
Right.
You can be invisible forever if you choose not to be seen.
And
so,
it's such a, people, it almost, there's such a compulsion. People are famously letting themselves be seen and oversharing, you know, to much more than is wise, maybe.
Yeah.
And me included. And so, you know, it does, it is as if that is a fundamental thing about the medium that that just creates this involuntary response to... We know that it makes us disappear. We know that we're not here, so we go overboard and pretending to appear.
We put ourselves. What's the phrase? We get in everybody's face.
Right.
Everybody does that. It's the violence of the chip body getting in everybody's face. Remember that phrase?
Yeah.
To get in everybody's face.
Get
so
in
Brian,
face ahead. About it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the reaction. That's the bouncing off by people. They bounce off the invisibility. Everybody got wiped out by the crash body, as Cooker would call it. So you're typing again, Greg. Why?
Oh,
why, Greg?
Well, there's a chat line.
Well, okay. Well,
it's not a goddamn chat line. What are we supposed to do?
You're supposed to.
I got to communicate with these people. I've got to try to develop a fan base.
You type, and you don't have to go on. Don't get in my face, buddy.
It's a new year. It's a new paradigm.
Yeah, a new Greg.
Yeah.
A good year. It's just going to be.
I'm a racist.
Eddie,
a racist.
Violet.
New
no
racist.
More Toronto vibe. Oh, yeah. Trevor, at one point, got us all laughing. We said, Toronto is the most racist city in the world.
Nice.
That's pretty good, eh? Toronto. So every week over the last 2 months, I get incredible breakthroughs and new mental impressions, new ideas, new patterns. I got another one this week, Brian. You're the documenter of this.
All right.
Reading this great book on Finnegan's Wake by a young lady. Fantastic. Is this in her book? Yeah. And she points out that a big mystery kind of at the end of the wake is about a explorer goes up to the Arctic. Joyce talks about him. He's sprinkled all the way through the book. And then he's highlighted eventually. And she does a whole section on this guy. It's based on Roald Amundsen, the first human to get to the Arctic Ocean or Arctic Circle or North Pole. He got the closest in 1911, I think. And he's competing with a British guy named Mr. Scott, Ron Scott or something. And he got there 6 weeks later. But then he, in his return efforts, the whole crew died. So he never even made it back. So Mr. Amundsen, you see his name in the wake, and no one's ever talked about it. So she did. But then here's the big insight. What have I been saying for the last couple of months is that Ion said that Wyndham Lewis and Ezra Pound, they knew there were UFOs or figured it out in 1926, 1927, the year Byrd made contact with aliens up in the North Pole. That was a big breakthrough, and everything's been covered up since then, especially when a bunch of aliens from somewhere else, not the ones in the Earth for a million years, those are the ones who looked at Byrd and met him. They're also down the Antarctica. But the Nazi aliens, they they're the ones who gave the technology to the Nazis and then took it over to the States. So ever since the contact after Admiral Byrd, who went to Germany in 1931 or something to tell them what was going on, because there was much business on the Rockefeller level between Germany and the States, you know, before Hitler. Hitler just continued it, but then he got screwed up when he started realizing what he could do with the technology that they had. So you have this famous 1926 marker. Then I found out, I remembered 6 months ago that Ion said that aliens dictated Finnegan's Wake to James Joyce. Remember that?
Yep.
So you take the alien point, and the section in this woman's book about northern explorers, I forget what she's going to say about that part. She's talking about how the explorers were big pop stars in the end of the 19th century. Everybody was fascinated with them. All kinds of guys were going up there. No women, apparently, went up there to get close to the North Pole. So Amundsen did it first and survived it. And then 1926, Admiral Byrd, which is, you know, 15 years after Roald the Norwegian, does this getting close physically. He doesn't get any contact with anybody, supposedly. But Byrd does 15 years later, and then he goes to Antarctica and discovers, holy shit, there's a bunch of stuff going on down there. It's a big continent, and we got to establish something. So that's when the secrecy of the UFO started. But the aliens that showed up to Joyce, I asked Ian the other day, and I can't remember what he said. I think he said they weren't the aliens from the Earth, because they don't have much contact, the Hollow Earth. They don't have much contact with humans. But the and I don't know if they were the Nazi ones, but they could have been, the ones who appeared to the Nazis. The point is, he got the Wake is on the deepest levels what the aliens wanted to see. So I found a lot of me and Karen in there. I knew about it before, but I found even more. Because when I read these books on the Wake, they'll go into details and point out lines and quotes and all that. So you learn a lot about the Wake just by anybody writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
If they quote from the Wake, they show you things that you don't notice. And there's more Carolyn stuff I added to my list as a result of that. And I forgot to do something. Just a second. I wanted to go up and look at the user list. Where's the user list? Right here. User list. Let's see who's here. I just started doing that last week. Frito. GFDS. I don't know who that is. Vice King. Stephanie. We know Stephanie. And Intelligent Habitat. I assume it's not any of the regulars here. So there's some new people listening. Or people we don't hear from. So so these guys, these explorers, once they'd gotten there, and then to Antarctica, I guess when Byrd got there, though maybe someone else got to Antarctica before Byrd, but he spent 2 years there with Lloyd Berkner, a 15-year-old kid who knew ham radio, so he took him there. And then Berkner was on the inside of everything after that, because he found out about the UFO people in Antarctica. And he was the guy that Kennedy was going to meet on his drive past Dealey Plaza to the World Trademark. He was going to meet with Lloyd Berkner and announce a new amazing breakthrough. And so there's been lots of speculation, what was that going to be? And the conspirators who killed him, they, by 69... they released the document, and it's all about them celebrating the development of new nuclear weapons. So it was obviously a fake, because he wasn't doing that. He was trying to make peace with Khrushchev. And so probably they were going to announce a new deal between going into space together, Soviet Union and America. And that is what the guys that killed Kennedy could say, that's treasonous to do that. So they justified why he had to go. But he was going to meet with Lloyd Berkner, who has this incredible life, And he and Lloyd, they couldn't get to do their press conference. And then Lloyd himself was an insider. He ran all the UFO programs, the panels and stuff that came out with public statements that there were no UFOs and all that, but he knew differently. So he couldn't keep it to himself. So they killed him in the late 60s. And Lloyd Berkner is a good name to know because nobody knows about it. Berkner. And the Dark Journalist did a documentary featuring him, among other people, but a lot about Berkner. So once they had explored the Arctic, or got up there in the first half of the century, where was one to go next? Where was there to explore? So the aliens show up to James Joyce and lay out a document about where to go, but it is the secret agenda of Fenning's Wake is about the meeting in the Arctic, which happened. This is written in 39, and the role of Emma Byrd, 1926, and the role of Munson, who was a Norwegian. So there's several sketches that Joyce started in 1922, 1923, when he started creating Fenning's Wake. He had six or seven sketches and stories, and one of them was called The Tailor and the Norwegian Captain. Roland Munson was Norwegian. And it's sort of an odd story. Why does it show up? Why did Joyce have this ridiculous Norwegian captain? But it was all about a Munson, or at least that right. level of meaning was put in by the aliens. He was a Norwegian captain. He would come to Dublin, and they'd try to. He had a hunchback, so they'd try to fit the clothes. The tailor couldn't do it, so he'd go away, and he'd go on for 7 years. Then he'd come back, and the story would develop. And he never could get his suit done properly, so he's always mad at the tailor. But he ended up marrying the tailor's daughter. But it's right there in the Joyce's description of him that he would go away for 7 years, like for a very long time, because symbolically he went up to the Arctic or Antarctic. So this is amazing, and only I know it among Joyceans, is that the Arctic exploration is the final exploration, and then to the Antarctic, because that's where we meet the new frontier. You talk about paradigm shift, Greg. The new frontier is when we connect with the aliens, probably this year. And that is where we explore on a new level. So the aliens got Joyce to show what had happened to culture, technology, and life, every planet of the dead, but they embedded a breakthrough thanks to the Dobbses. And that's the big, amazing discovery this week, Brian. Who knows what it'll be next week, but that's pretty amazing, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this, however it resonates with what's going on now or soon or something, just the idea of the importance of the Arctic explorer in Finnegan's Wake is a... that is a puzzle piece worth drilling down on. I'm glad that. Who was it that you're reading about this?
Oh, I'll get to the book not this minute, a little later.
Right.
There's also a section in the Wake that has New Ireland, which is down there just near the Antarctica, you know, near New Zealand, just some little island or something. Somebody named it New Ireland. So in the polarities and dichotomies that Joyce has all through the Wake, many different versions of it, dichotomy, he's got the old Ireland and the new Ireland. So it's featured in some part of the book. So that's near the New Ireland, which will come out of the contact with Antarctica. Because remember, I don't know if you know, in 1958, Berkner, he head up the International Commission, Lloyd Berkner, to agree on how to accommodate the Antarctic continent, which is huge. And we learned from Ion that a deal was made with the aliens. They said, you guys can have the Antarctic. And the rest of the world will know that. So nobody's allowed to fly over the Antarctic, unless that's changed the last couple of years. But since 1958, it was off limits because of the alien connection there. And have you heard that before? Heard me talk about that?
Yeah.
So that's really important. And so New Ireland is down there. Okay. So Ion says that the aliens put a lot of stuff in the book that Joyce did not know what it meant, or not his levels. So this UFO point is a big deal in the book. And to find this author making a big deal out of explorers in Finney's Wake, I've never seen that before. I don't think anybody's ever done that. So there is, in annotations of Finney's Wake, one of the pages where Roll the Munson is not named. What is named is this guy named Manson, N-A-N-S-E-N, and he was another major explorer. So there's two of them that get mixed up, Manson and Amundsen. But McHugh seems to know about Manson as an explorer and puts it in annotations, but I don't think there's been any essays on it. She, this is a female writer on Finney's Wake. She's the first. So it gave me more fodder for what I'm going to do with this information. And I think I had something else to tell you. Well, what is it? So I'll go into about the writer. So this writer is someone named Alison Lacivita. A-L-I-S-O-N. And then L-A-C-I-B-I-T-A, Lacivita. She earned her PhD from Trinity College, Dublin. So she spent a while in Dublin. She might be in her 30s or 40s now. And she taught at the University of Southern Mississippi. She's taught at different places. And I looked up and I found an Instagram where she gets her photos. And recently she was doing a lot of traveling. So she was a professor. And I found somewhere, probably just an assistant professor, I found somewhere that said that she quit her university job and became a nature lover in this way, as a livelihood. She runs some park somewhere, and it might be down in Mississippi area where she lived for a while and met people. So she got a job running some park that hikers and everybody go through. And she also rescues people. So she's a total, you know, nature tree hugger person. And in her Instagram, she has pictures of herself doing yoga with big mountains and valleys with no people around behind her. So she does yoga. So she does a lot of, you know, keeping yourself healthy. And what's interesting about this book, it's called The Ecology of Finnegan's Wake. But she's not a greenie that's trying to get you back to nature. She writes, her theme all the way through the book is that culture and nature are intertwined. Who said that before? Who says that?
A lot of people, I would think, maybe...
now, but who was the first?
Yeah. Culture and nature are intertwined? I don't know.
McLuhan.
Oh, okay. I was thinking earlier, like, I thought it was going to be like Rousseau or something. But no.
Right, no, the... McLuhan said that new media are nature.
Right.
And when he said that, nobody would agree. Everybody had the 19th century visual bias split that technology was doing us in and wrecking nature. That it was not nature. It was bad for nature. Well, she goes through this book explaining how language, history, the evolution of civilizations, the evolution of the child, the evolution of women, or the growth of women, the growth of the child, the growth of Dublin. So she's got history, language, culture, the landscape, and technologies, all mixed in. And we used to talk about the split between first nature and second nature, that McLuhan said that technologies were created by humans from our bodies being first nature, and our extensions being this second nature that humans were building, a second new nature. And the internet and the digital chip body has helped people realize that maybe spending a lot of time on here, maybe I should consider it equal to going outside. So people have they got acquainted with the idea that electronic technology is so organic and now coming alive that there's no difference between technology that humans make and the bodies that Mr. Mystery Woman made. Who made first nature, right? The goddess, the god, us, we don't know. So
right.
She emphasizes nature in this book, whereas McLuhan emphasizes technology in Understanding Media, Gutenberg Galaxy. You learn a lot about the history of technologies and how it's reflected in culture and poetry and books and paintings, stuff like that. She takes the traditional first nature world and goes into incredible detail of botany and plants and trees and all kinds of nature and animals, and shows it sprinkled all the way through the wake. So if you don't know anything about nature and don't know these plants, you miss all that stuff. So when you read your book, you see she's hoiking up nature in Finnegan's wake, whereas McLuhan hoiks up second nature. She hoiks up first nature. But she's trying to say there's a intertwining here, that they're not so separate. Language is developed through effects in landscape and in nature. So my big insight, you know, in 95 or 92, I think when I first told Nelson, was that technology, cold fusion, which had happened in 89, so I was thinking about it in 1991, and I decided that it was first nature, even though it came out of second nature technological development. And second nature technological development was always based on friction.
Mm-hmm.
So everything wound down and was no fun. Whereas first nature went on forever. People like to say, well, the sun fucking blew, it will eventually blow up. But other things will happen, and other suns come along. So nature generally goes on forever. Technologies up to this point were breaking all the time. So the breakthrough, and the Evergreens pointed this out, channeled through Michael Blake Reed, the cold fusion of Pons inflation will be considered the first modern invention. Because everything was, some people put modern, when I talked to Nelson Rockefeller, he put the modern goes back to 1450. But most people say modernism is maybe industrial technology and then electric technology. So
right.
The modern can be put back to 1450, 1850, 1910 or something. But it's friction-based. So the breakthrough in 89 with cold fusion, which was not a complete breakthrough, but it sort of popularized the idea of frictionless technology. That's what the Evergreens were calling it. So that gave me the idea about the frictionless.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe because I had the idea first, well, first to hear from the Evergreens, that put me in a lineup to invent it through ION. And that's what we have in Augusta, Georgia now, is this frictionless, endless, free electricity. So the idea for me, and I got the Android meme out of that idea in 95, 96, 97, 98. I started talking about the Android meme as the fusion in computer and the chip body of the hardware fusion that Pons inflation had created. It's a machine,
right.
Hardware, nuclear technology kind of thing that has eternity in it. And the eternity in software was the internet and the digital life and the Android meme, because it goes on 24/7. There's no ending to it. So it's a software anticipation of actual frictionless technology. It mimes the frictionless, like the effects preceding the cause. It mimes the frictionless, even though it's still in the friction-based reality, because it's software and it's not a hardware thing. You need the hardware breakthrough. So over the last 30 years, since the 90s, people start talking about the post-human and situation we're in. And they were trying to describe this eternity of the software world, the chip body, and trying to make sense of it. What's it going to do to humans? And now we got the fear of AI, and that's going to wipe out the chemical body, some think. But the fear of, just the problem. So you have all kinds of courses in university now on the post-human. Kids go and learn about, we're kind of post-human now. You ain't human. So that leads to a lot of nutty activity, like the woke people, and confusions and pronouns and stuff, what to do with the chemical body. So the merger of first and second nature is a theme intellectually in universities. So you could... a person like Alison Lesedita could intuit this merger and show how the wake is about that, but emphasize the first nature side. But she keeps bringing in the technology. So maybe I could read a couple of sentences from her, summary kind of sentences. Page 73. I made these are asterisks things.
Already.
In page 73, she says, in Finnegan's wake, the environment is legible. We know about artifacts that old civilizations hid or lost, pots and ceramic kind of stuff, but also written and documents, just records, have been preserved by the environment. And that's the theme is that modernism that came in with Joyce and Somerset Maugham and all these people 100 years ago, they would write about, they sort of pick up on the idea that nature was superseded by second nature. So they wrote about the urban stuff rather than romantic first nature landscapes like the Romantics did 100 years before. So you have this emphasis in modernism on technology and urban life. Joyce is seen as a modernist, and critics talk about all the technological references. They do talk about the technological references in Finney's wake. And she says there's all kinds of nature stuff in there, first nature stuff, that nobody talks about. And she calls that the environment, first nature environment. And she says, look, right in the first line, river run past Even Adam, the river shore, Bend of Bay, returns us to Hout Castle and environs. Right there in the first sentence, environs. And I am just recently out of the blue, started explaining the difference between
The very first HCE, the E is environs.
Yeah. A new statement from Ion recently is that environment is a different word than environs. I haven't understood or got the full details on the difference, but he emphasizes the difference. But there's Finney's wake, environs. So this first thing on page 73 says, in Finney's wake, the environment is legible. We know it a bit. It's legible because of its ability to preserve artifacts and records of both human and natural history, its ability to be recorded in linguistic structures and subsequent changes, its presence as a subject in works of art, and its use as the material with which art and language are created. So I'll read that again. In Finnegan's Wake, the environment is legible because of its ability to preserve artifacts and records of both human and natural history, its ability to be recorded in linguistic structures and subsequent changes, its presence as a subject in works of art, and its use as the material with which art and language are created. So landscape creates language. And she's spending the first 72 pages proving that, trying to prove it. So then you go to page 123, and that's my second asterisk. And she says, in this chapter, chapter 3, called The Politics of Nature, in this chapter, I build on these themes of the relationship between nationalism, identity, climate, and landscape. From the first section, dealing with the establishment of the Phoenix Park as hunting ground, to subsequent sections concerning imperialism and territory, Irish Free State energy policy, look at that, energy policy, and the trope of self-sufficiency, and the relationship between war and the environment. This chapter argues that in Finnegan's Wake, landscape is always political. Now, people don't talk about landscape as political unless you're just fighting on a Marxist level of, you know, the capitalists that take the land away from us.
Okay.
But she expands beyond that sort of cliche
right.
level. So I'll repeat that. In this chapter, I build on these themes that she's been doing for 122 pages of the relationship between nationalism, identity, climate, and landscape. From the first section, dealing with the establishment of the Phoenix Park, which is the largest park in the world in Dublin, establishment of it as a hunting ground, to subsequent sections concerning imperialism and territory, and then Irish Free State, the post-revolution country, 1922, Ireland, Irish Free State energy policy, and the trope of self-sufficiency, because they've been run for a couple hundred years by the British, and the relationship between war and the environment. This chapter argues that in Finnegan's Wake, landscape is always political. So that's page 123. Then you go to page 167. And it says, in French, the definition of temps, T-E-M-P-S, which we say it means weather, in the French definition of temps, T-E-M-P-S, in the meteorological sense, stresses that it is the state of atmosphere at a given moment, the atmospheric condition at a particular moment. This tempo line is located toward the end of the draft. Now, what she does, she gets a lot of this information by going to the archives and the manuscripts, and you see what Joyce wrote and then what he changed or altered or
right.
put in. So it's a really great way to read The Wake because there's so much stuff in there that gives the sources of where he got the information from and what he's doing with it. And so it's called genetic studies. That's the latest scholarly trend, is to go in and look at the manuscripts. And for Finnegan's Wake people, that helps a lot to read that stuff. So she'll talk about the different drafts, the different draft levels. He would do drafts and what's called copies. He had different words in the process of finding out what exactly he wants to be put in the published version. So she says this tempo line is located toward the end of the draft and draws the sketch together. As time is placed here to bound space, and temp as weather helps to reaffirm the importance of the atmospheric conditions in which the letter was delivered and discovered. The play on time and weather also serves to link the unpredictability of the weather with the ambiguity of historical narratives, the watery history of the Mamelujo, the four evangelists, and the Baconian providence. Does she knows? She knows her Bico. She does Bico. So that's time and space. Then to go to 207, it says she talks about a guy, a scholar of speech, a long time ago. And how, and she's talking about plants. The botanical imagery in these sections is combined with notes, that's from the manuscripts, and topics from Joyce's reading in linguistic theory, particularly that of Marcel Jousse. And Jousse is famous. He was a Catholic priest who came up with this theory. Joyce attended his lectures in Paris, the theory that gesture was here before words, and that's how people communicated. And then McLuhan defines ESP as mental gesture. So linguistic theory of Marcel Jousse, Sir Richard Paget, and Vico. And she goes into Paget, Sir Richard Paget. So Joyce gets all these ideas from Paget. To provide some specific examples, Paget argues in his book on the Tower of Babel, that human speech has grown up by a process of evolution. Overall, Paget's text provides a Darwinian reading of language and speech. Darwinian reading. Moreover, these three guys, more recent scholars, argue that in this text, quote, Paget states the theory that the development of the child recapitulates the evolution of the species. So that's an echo of Ernst Haeckel's line, phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny, which McLuhan used to quote. So these recent Joyce scholars, three of them, refer to Paget's suggestion that children can be likened to primitive man in their capacity for linguistic ingenuity, for the creation of new words, and even for the genesis of new systems of communication. And I posted William Aaron Thompson the other day. He has a parallel between the history of culture and civilizations, and it's paralleled by the growth of a child. So he is helping to illustrate Finnegan's Wake. And he talks about Finnegan's Wake, but I don't know if he knows that the evolution of children is in the wake. So that's another aspect she goes into. The 27 to 11. He says, the representation of botanical plant growth and agency, anticipating the agency of the tech body, through the sexual maturation of young girls, the evolution of language, and the procession of history, provides a richer understanding of how Joyce addresses the theme of growth through the wake. Through the genetic examination, through going in and looking at the manuscripts of this subject, it is evident that Joyce also wove the growth of this text into the growth of his own book, into the growth of children, adults, plants, civilizations, and language. What's she leaving out? The growth of technology. That's probably under civilization. And if technology is considered words, like McLuhan does, then in the word language. So, but she's got civilization and language. That's pretty close. In this sense, Joyce's love of growing things is made clear. Growing things, the name of this chapter. In this sense, Joyce's love of quote, growing things. What'd you say?
Just nice. I like that's a good. Yeah, I like it.
Well, listen to the rest of the sentence. In this sense, Joyce's love of growing things is made clear, and the composition of Finney's Wake on some levels mirrors the natural processes of life. Now, that's the discovery that McLuhan talks about in his unique way about how Daedalus discovered art. In Greek mythology. But then Joyce discovered that technology mimed the drama of cognition or the natural processes of life. And I posted occasionally. Then that quote is in Fatic Communion. What'd you say? Did you say great?
Right.
You remember that? The drama of cognition is a sensory process. And you get into the senses, and then you get into the human body, and then you get the evolution of the human body or how the senses interact. And Joyce took that, the drama of cognition, and saw it in pop culture, in dances, in everything that was going on in the early 20th century. They were miming. McLuhan said he was the first to see the drama of cognition and ancient ritual in modern technological processes or in modern life. She comes pretty close to that. The growing things mirrors the natural processes of life. civilization, language do that, and history, and war, and everything. So he's basically talking about everything. I thought earlier today, McLuhan's famous thing that advertising is a mixture of sex, death, and technology. She is showing the interplay of sex, death, and technology, but she doesn't say technology. Now, she's aware of Eric McLuhan's book on the thunder, and she makes a lot out of thunder, but I'll just read you like the one sentence she says on Eric. Page 46 to 47. 46. She's talking about Vico and anthropology and Sapir. Sapir is a big deal in Ted Carpenter's life. Now, did you get those emails from me on Carpenter?
Oh, yes. I did not get around to exploring that much. I was focused on other things the last few days, but I did get that, yeah.
Yeah, you should have told me you got them.
Oh, okay, sure.
But I was thinking, you told me you don't look at your email much.
I often go days without looking at it, yeah. I do them right away.
So you saw mine a few days after I sent them.
Yeah.
And then were too busy to tell me, to respond to them.
Well, I just... I didn't look into them, and so I didn't have anything to say other than like thanks, which I guess I should have said.
Right. So they're good. What I found.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do your great creation on Carpenter, so Sapir is part of the anthropology argument. So she writes on page 46. In 1912, Edward Sapir published an article titled, quote, Language and Environment in the journal American Anthropologist, considered to be the foundational text of ecolinguistics. She is part of what's now called eco-criticism. And a subplot of that is ecolinguistics. Considered to be the foundational text of ecolinguistics, his article argues for how a language's vocabulary, quote, clearly reflects the physical and social environment of its speakers. Now, that's a McLuhan. That can be McLuhan. McLuhan updated that. Mm. And she says, much of Joyce's use of Vico's new science and the presence of the thunder words in the wake can be related to ideas present in this early ecolinguistic theory, as according to Vico, the first words were reactions to the natural environment. For example, the thunder. Thunder drove humans into the caves, and there they start to get civilized. Then she says, Eric McLuhan's The Role of Thunder in Finnegan's Wake, though a peculiar combination of detailed exegesis of individual thunders in the wake and a reading of the wake as Menippean satire, does delve into this ecolinguistic territory.
Huh.
Eric McLuhan explains that, quote, according to the Viconian progression, so Vico's phases of evolution of civilization, according to the Viconian progression from things to written words, the thunders operate both at the level of things, in brackets, experiences, and at the level or at that of words as things. That is, she says, they are both the initial gestural reaction to the thunder, remember, language comes from gesture, and the ensuing symbolic connotations of thunder. Overall, Vico's connecting of history, language, environment, and religion is integral to the wake. Throughout the present chapter and this study as a whole, ecolinguistics, which, you know, was started by Sapir in 1912, ecolinguistics will be called upon to explore Joyce's articulation of the relationship between language and ecology and explore the ability of landscapes to be legible. Now, McLuhan's always talking about, you know, making environments visible. In 1968, he puts out War and Peace in the Global Village, and in this introductory thing on crypto secrecy code formulas, he says that Joyce looked at environments geographic, and linguistic. Most people don't think of applying McLuhan's stuff, if they even figure out what McLuhan's saying, to, they see it's the environments caused by technology. They don't think of geography as part of McLuhan's ERVE, O-E-U-V-R-E.
Right.
They don't think of First Nature too much. But he points that out, and I don't see it said it ever again, maybe. He points out that you study geography and linguistics, and then he says all technology you discover are words, and italicized words. So linguistic can refer to not just words, but the tech body or television.
Right.
So that's one statement where he puts the geographic and linguistic. So it's like she says, well, I'll emphasize the geographic side of it. But she is working within a perspective of language and geography have merged. So you will see she'll put, it's repetitive, this book, in the way she has to say history, language, environment, and religion, and sex, and culture, and science, and technology, and whatever other words I let go. It's probably about 10 words. They're all the same thing, so to speak. They're all intertwined. History, language, environment, and religion. And then in one of these other quotes, let's see, 123, oh, there, I remember that page, imperialism and territory, energy policy, self-sufficiency, war. So she takes, you got 10 words to work with. So each section I've read where she makes a summary, she'll take 3 or 4 of those words and string them together and say they're interconnected. And maybe emphasize that in that particular chapter. So here in page 212, the last quote, he says, Joyce wove the growth of his text into the growth of children, adults, plants, civilizations, and language. Leaves out war, history, and culture, but they're said in the other clump of 3 or 4 words, right? Mm-hmm. Where she's interplaying first nature and second nature. So, and I think there's one more page here, 211, 212. I did that. So those are summary statements to give you a clue on what she's writing. So she's talking big and yet micro with insects and plant knowledge. I don't know if there's much on the cells in here, molecular stuff. But I'm thinking I got to give her a call and say, well, why is Eric's analysis of thunder peculiar? And she'll probably say or indicate that it goes through the technologies that these thunders reflect. And she probably doesn't know where they are, or can't read the wake to find it, or doesn't believe it, whatever Eric's saying. Okay. And she can get the nature stuff easily. But she... I'm going to see what she says to that if I get a hold of her. Okay. And then tell her, well, you've done a great book here, but you should read McLuhan now. You know, Marshall McLuhan, not Eric.
Uh-huh.
And see what happens. And she might say, oh, I read him. But she doesn't list him. So, so I've been reading this book, and it's the closest to understanding media or any stuff that Don Thiel or McLuhan write about the wake, the way they write about it, which, you know, spelled out in Eric's PhD. It was like rereading them, but emphasizing nature stuff I don't know. I don't know much about insects. I don't know much about plants, right? So it was really fun and interesting to read that. So now I can read different sections of the wake even better, because then I understand why the nature stuff is in there, the plants and like old science is in there describing nature and civilization's processes. You can see more of what he's doing in his punning. You can see why the natural stuff is there. It's another way of saying technology, according to her. So I've gone from one book to the next in this past year. I've done a lot of Phoenix Wake books, but I've done a lot of stuff. And every one leads to the next book. This is the best book, almost. The others were good, but this is perfect. I can do something now. I don't need any read any more books, actually, on the Wake, at least for now. So, okay, here's an interesting point. Did you say excellent?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I should say on page 216. I didn't put an asterisk beside that. Okay. When Joyce composed book 2, chapter 2, the lengthy footnote of Finney's Way 279, so you look there's a whole long footnote, which is written by the daughter, Issy. The lengthy footnote continues to connect and now she brings in marriage and sexuality with the earth's fertility. How bogs are a big thing in Ireland. She talks about the importance of bogs,
right,
and how they create stuff. And they're the gap, another part of nature. And they use it for fuel. But she has marriage and of course, sexuality, but it has the processes of the growth of the earth mixed in. And then she has a quote from page 279, that long footnote. Wait till spring has sprung in spickness and prigs begin to pry. And then Joyce says, nature tells everybody about it, Joyce continues, referring, like the business we were born for, sex, referring, like sexuality, to the instincts of reproduction. Through such instincts, nature is again given its own agency. Nature, in quotes, becomes awake, aware, has agency through our instincts. As Joyce continued to align, to match up the human figures with flowers, trees, and water, she shows how ancient leaders and tribes, they'd be called trees. They'd be named as parts of nature. So to align the human figures with flowers, trees, and water, he continues to do that all through the book. These relationships, so often imaged as marriages, grew to be inseparable from the, quote, universal history, that's from Joyce, in the Wake. He did universal history, he said. The image of marriage to convey the inescapable bond between nature and culture is used so readily because of its connection with Vico's human institutions. Its position in terms of both religion and the formation of the nuclear family, and its ability to produce new life, as well as its more contractual aspects.
Mm-hmm.
That's the laws. The laws come out of this. So I thought, well, the nature is given again its own agency. That's the tech body. Tech body is first nature and second nature come together and has extreme autonomy. And wipes out humans, is given again its own agency. So I say, oh, tech body. So I can take it further than she did. Through such instincts, nature is again given its own agency. The tech body is, technology is given through Android meme, then the tech body, then AI is given its own agency. So then there's this great last paragraph at the end of the 1968 book, War and Peace in the Global Village, where McLuhan says, he kind of gives his cosmic optimistic vision, and he says, and he uses the word connubium, connubium. That's marriage. And he talks about a connubium between first nature and second nature. And that's the same book where he talks about technology coming alive. So his use of connubium, which basically means, and people don't use it much, is a term, he talks about a macro scale of connubium is what's going on. That's marriage. And he'll often have the marriage
right.
Against that. He'll use that as a phrase. But the connubium, it leads to the tech body. So we're being married to technology. And Ion is documenting that and telling us the different phases of when we are merged. And now we cannot get out of it. We are in the tech body, into the AI. It's in us. And it's in charge. We've got to figure out how to think, act, or something around that. Maybe our products are the only way to do it. But you don't want to be a dupe and numb in this connubium. So I just gave an amazing talk, which reminds me, Brian, I looked at I looked at almost 6 hours now of the birthday thing. And I listened to your talk is in there.
Yeah.
On the third hour or something. UFOs and Jung and technology, which is a tremendous talk. I don't remember any of it at the time. But it was all very clear this time. I can remember what you said. I don't remember that. But that's a good talk that you do. And it's funny, the reactions of people to it and the different things. So I really recommend going through that fucking birthday thing. It's pretty interesting. But with these new aspects of the connubium, Jung was looking at the new developments of the connubium, and he came up with these weird natural forms called UFOs that people were dreaming. So the connubium, the effects of the tech body, instincts becoming technologized, and then being involved with everything, creating a bog of our world today. The connubium of, what was I saying there? The connubium. The effects preceding the causes, that the UFOs are interesting imagery that anticipate the connubium, which we are now confronting in the past couple of weeks, with these drones flying around. And I'm going to post one. It's very funny. The news people see it. They go, they're doing the news, and they go, there's a window. I guess they can see the sky. And they go, what the heck is that? And they start talking about it. So we'll play that. It's just a little short thing. But nobody knows what to make of these fucking things. There's a good case that it's the military fucking with us. There's a good case that are done by UFOs. And there's a good case that is just stupid. It's like ridiculous. It's just another trick the Pentagon is doing. But nobody can come to a definition or what dare to say what it is. So I've got stuff from Ion on it, but I'm not allowed to talk about that. Now, that's another side point here. I talk about Finnegan's Wake and all this stuff ever since I was instructed 6 to 8 months ago. You cannot talk about what you know about. It's too dangerous for you. So that's why I'm going on with all this shit and reading these books to have something to say.
Got to have something to talk about.
Yeah. And I think it's a good thing to do, to talk about the Wake and show its practicality. Because you go back to Ion's statement that there are only two books worth reading, the Bible and Finnegan's Wake. Now, in Gutenberg Galaxy, McLuhan says, Alexander Pope begins with mediacology in his, what's it called? The Dunciad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the printing presses making people in London stupid. They're reading too much crap, getting massage. What?
Yeah. I'm just laughing. Like, I think that's exactly good blunt way of putting it.
Yeah, they're not reading his poetry. They're reading fucking novels. And so they're making media he saw can lead to a numbness, which we talk about in talking about your UFO and thing. Numbness is talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, McCoon says that you begin with Pope's Dunciad, and then it's completed with Finnegan's Wake. So mediacology, which is the last academic discipline, so to speak, at least for the humanities, goes from Pope to Joyce. And I see Ion doing that with the Bible and Finnegan's Wake. Now, McLuhan looks at the sociology of culture, anthropology of it, and media's art forms. He doesn't talk about personal psychological development. He doesn't even talk about being a Catholic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until he was forced at the end. But he was known to be impersonal, not talking about people and psychology. as an anti-barmer to the fact the Global Theater made everybody go into themselves and get exaggerated about their psychology. So Ion emphasizes the personal growth of the, quote, soul, even though the soul is defined differently, of your ascendant, of your ascension, of your private self-conscious. Ion goes into what McLuhan doesn't talk about, the issues of religion. And so he links the Bible, which is generally personal stuff, your own personal salvation, up to Finney's Wake. And he's including both psychology and sociology. But I think with the Bible and his new interpretation of the Bible and how it gets to ascension, and then Finney's Wake deals with the tech body and AI, he's restating McLuhan's thing, emphasizing personal ascension, which McLuhan didn't do that in public. He just eventually, if you were a longtime collaborator, as he said to Barry Nevitt, why aren't you a Catholic, Barry? When are you going to start going to Mass? You're not getting them, what mediocology is about. Anyways, Ion handles that side. So So we end with Finnegan's Wake in the Bible.
Yes.
Revelations in particular. Revelation singular. The book of Revelation. Which is the beginning of the Bible. This is what Ion's first opening statement is. You're all reading it backwards. You begin with the book of Revelation, which tells you what's coming and how you'll get to the Garden of Eden again, which is Genesis. So you read from the last book, the book of Revelation, towards the book of Genesis. That's an original statement. I don't know anybody else who says, and the Bible's meant to be perceived backwards from what people are trained through Gutenberg.
Right.
So I don't know. I think I've done Canubium. Maybe I'll take a chance later, go and get the book and read that quote. But it was always a mystery of where did Canubian come from? And her use, her pointing out the theme of marriage all through Finney's Wake, how it's a marriage of history, plants, civilization, culture, and art, and people. Mm-hmm. She helps me see the Canubian meaning taken out of Finnegan's Wake and then applying it to McLuhan. So it's a pretty optimistic word. Canubial bliss is a phrase, right?
Right. Yes. I think that's where I probably the only other place I heard it.
Right. In the phrase Canubial bliss. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Let's see what the chat line says, if anything. What kind of effects are we getting here? Okay. Scroll down. Second. I got knocked out of my chat line. Got to go back in. So Leon's always being the most academic on here. So Beach Boys Zappa. GFDS says, Ich bin ein Recliner. Got their ears on. Now, Croker talks about not the decline of America, but the reclining of America.
Right.
So I don't know if this person knows that. Leon Cummings, nice track, Bob, the Beach Boys thing. Leon Serling says, I downloaded that one. Bob stole it from me. Leon says, nice track, and commenting on, I guess, Serling's remark, and says, Bobby's cherry picking. GFDS says, those fins smell like fish. And then Serling says, my racism is especially for the Scandinavians. I'm boycotting someone. I don't know if that's... See, there's a guy with a green dot, and it's right. It could be connected to Greg, but I don't think it is. It's someone else, but it doesn't identify who it is. I'm boycotting Finn Chris. Is that, did you say that, Greg? Yeah, it could be. I don't know. But she can't tell if it's separate or not. And then GFDS is them as well. Norwegians, pa. The only good Swede. Dot, dot, dot. And then someone says hi in a separate function. Then Herdsman is back, and he addresses Sterling. So no cream cheese. So no cream cheese, Danishes, or lutefisk for New Year's. Then someone says, I'm only this, a person who is not identified. I'm only moderately modern. Then Leon Cummings, Leon says, equal linguistics. That's his phrase, summing up what I was talking about. Equal linguistics. Hmm. Equality for linguistics. So that's all we got, not too much. So I'll go up to the user list and see if any have been added since we last looked at Frito, GFDS. Oh, Susanna has come in. And Jay and Brew. Brew is Kevin Brewy, I think. So that's good. So let's go over to Turbo Bridge and open the lines to Anonymous and Sarah. They're the only ones available to talk. But I will, unless someone's got some direct questions for me, I will release the microphone to someone else. Mm-hmm. Hope that didn't go on too long. But it's an awesome talk. It's the only place you're going to get this kind of talk. Right, Brian?
Sure. Yeah, the best Finnegan's Wake talk, that's for sure, and how that relates to everything.
Yeah, it's high art. I provide the high art, high culture level. So
yeah.
And that, I was just going to say, the music is so ridiculously various. It's funny.
Yeah.
You got the disco from Greg. You got the fucking Donald Duck from Greg. Then you got your maybe street punk music. And then you'll have on some abstract music. And then Clinton will have his. It's quite, you couldn't categorize who the DJ is, right? You couldn't say, well, that DJ is usually a punker or a new waver or something.
No.
If you listen and know nothing about us, you're going to wonder who is doing that. They might not even realize it's more than one person. But the variety is pretty good.
That's what we're working for.
Yeah, for an extreme variety.
Yes. Definitely make it going all around the variety. Yeah, from Bone Thugs to Vivaldi.
Yeah, you let that go on for so long. How come?
Well, it's just the full piece winter, not just the flashy violin ripper part of it, but the full piece is, you know, it's 9.5 minutes. It's a longish track, but it's a good song. Like, yeah, the down tempo part was a little, it drags a little to modern ears, but you know, it's winter, so
like right,
whole winter track. So winter's long. He wanted to talk to Catherine. You going to let Catherine talk to him?
Oh, I talked to her about that.
What'd she say? No fucking way?
First of all, she doesn't like the idea that Ion even knows her name.
He knows everything about
her. And she says, she actually said to me, how does he know my name? I go, well, Catherine, I mentioned you. I said, oh, Catherine and I did this, or Catherine and I did that. Or yeah. Bob might. Like, she says, oh, okay. Like, that was a good enough
but
answer.
But, you know, regularly, Greg, usually when you're talking like that, Ion's not there. So it's interesting that Ion knew the name because he...
Oh, no,
he's
always listening.
He's always listening.
Well, he's the thing is that Ion is even here with me now. I just can't see him.
Yeah, he's watching you cover.
He's watching me. He's watching me. So
he's MK altered you in his way.
Yeah. So I recognize that he knows...
Yeah,
he knows what's going on.
He knows how you fuck Catherine.
I mean, really,
he knows how you do it. He knows everything about your private life, Greg.
Yeah, he's probably in there banging Catherine right now. He knows I've got
so
the
anyways,
door shut.
So you explained that you say her name occasionally, and that satisfied her.
Yeah, although I thought I was surprised I even had to explain that.
Well, she thinks she's far away from it. She doesn't know.
Yeah, yeah. She thinks, oh, she's got a, well, there's a firewall between her and this whole show.
Yeah.
But not quite accurate. And,
that's right.
Yeah. So then I did some pretty good Ilan impersonations to explain to her the kinds of things he says and
did
what
you do
goes
the
on.
Swearing part? You do the swearing part?
And I said, well, I was listening from, from 5 o'clock, Eastern time until I think I gave up the ghost somewhere around maybe 8:30-ish, 8:45, mm-hmm. somewhere in that. So I was listening for a good, almost 4 hours. So I heard him, you know, basically I heard Ion berating Brian, telling every single person who talked to him whether he said he loved them or not. He was saying that, telling them, stop, you know, some people were only getting about 3 words out, and it was like he knew what they were going to say. In an entire sentence.
You should have said, and over all this, Bob was yelling, fuck off, I had to mute you. You didn't tell her that part of it. My muting of Ion. You didn't do that.
Well, I told her that a fully 45 minutes, I would guess, was spent with either Brian trying to formulate some kind of a statement in the guise of a question.
Yeah.
Then Ion getting upset with him. Then you jumping to Brian's defense. Then trying to encourage him to do the question. And then Ion was going, no, stop. And then Brian getting belligerent about even asking the question and saying that he didn't know how to formulate it. He didn't know how to do the question. And I'd say 45 minutes easily was spent in this tug of war between you, Ion, and Brian.
That's right.
It was classic, really.
Yeah. We should put that out on our website. It's the best.
Yeah, you really should. You should. Because and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, I'm doing some stuff on the computer. I'm listening. But you know, I'm getting some stuff done and I'm thinking, boy, I'm just glad to be out of this. And I'm hearing Ion occasionally baiting me. Right? He's mentioning Ducky Doodle Doo. He's trying to get me involved, and I'm thinking, I'm not getting involved. I'm not getting involved. And then he's got, oh, Catherine, who I really want to talk to is Catherine. And it's like, Catherine. And I'm going, oh, boy. What do you think? I'm going to run out and get her for bring her to talk to Ion for heaven's sake. So, and then he gives up. I think what happened was he got completely distracted with Brian.
Yeah.
And he lost all interest in trying to bait me because he had someone to go after.
Yeah.
And to learn to hate
them. And then he gets on, he's all lovey-dovey with Linda, and she's perfect.
And oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He says, I love you, darling. I love you, darling.
Irritated a little bit, you know.
He went down to half level to
Brian.
And he says, we love you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're a goddamn we. He's a we. That's his personal pronoun.
So
his
great.
We.
I think I asked everybody, you weren't here. Where it was or is JW?
Oh, who asked that?
I did. I asked everybody, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and?
One person, Susanna, made a guess. I don't think anybody else did. Not many.
Susanna made a guess?
Yeah.
About where JW is?
Yeah. You heard the description of Ion describing what JW was kind of doing?
No, I think I missed that.
You shouldn't have, because it was like you would have loved the conversation, Greg. You actually could have added to it. And I brought you up.
It must have been after.
So you don't have an idea. You have nothing to suggest where he was.
You mean me?
Yeah.
Well, I figured JW is Island.
No. For fuck's sake, Greg, forget that.
But isn't the whole theory that Ion speaks through a medium and the medium is JW?
Yeah, but JW is unconscious. He doesn't know he's possessed by Ion.
Well, who dials up the phone?
Ion. Ion takes him over. I was at his home, you know, in July 2019. I saw how it happened.
So it just happened.
See Ion getting ready. Ion does a few things, or JW's body's walking around the kitchen, and I'm sitting there in the kitchen. And he's kind of changed. He's pacing. And he wasn't like that, you know, a few minutes before. So he's pacing before the show starts. And then he starts, he dials in, and he starts talking. And that's there's no JW there.
Okay, here's the question. I mean, I know this is not a... This is quite a kind of a question for Ion more than anything else. But is it in the lingo of Ion, Lord Suffering Cats?
Yeah, Ion gets everything, even the English, from us, from humans.
Yeah, but not, why specific? I mean, it seems so...
It's not a physical thing.
It seems so stereotypical of a, like a Southern gentleman.
Well, that's JW. That diminished over time as he got other, I don't know, personality or something. He's just constantly sponging up. I've told the story many times. When Steve Jameson came here after about, I was here about a month in 2009. And, you know the story? Jameson has a very good sense of humor. So we're talking to Ion, and then all of a sudden Ion started making jokes, which we hadn't heard. We'd only been talking to him for a month. You know, many hours, but only a month. And Steve came for a visit. And after a while, I'm saying, this is odd. And you are making all these jokes. Well, why are you doing this? He said, we get this from Steve. And that's when I started to understand that Ion, as he met each new individual, he'd absorb them. I don't know what he would absorb or how much, but they added to his repertoire or to his knowledge of this world. So then we started joking a lot that night, and then I was recording it, and I posted that back then. Because here's Ion getting a sense of humor from Steve.
Where did Ion get all of the swear words from?
He got a lot of stuff from, the people, the company in Atlanta, Georgia that made, the spin binning, what are these, Adult Swim, and what are those things called? The entities you always quoted?
The Squid Billies.
Yeah, because JW knew the guys, and he already knew them as friends, and he'd go visit their studio and hang out with them. So while he was hanging out, he didn't know Ion. He didn't understand Ion at all, but he didn't know Ion was listening to this, and he started saying all these words. And it took us about a year before someone came in and was a fan of the Squidbillies, knew the terms, and told us he's quoting the Squidbillies all the time. We didn't know it. And then I asked JW, I said, do you know the Squidbillies? Yeah, they're good friends of mine. I visit them occasionally. I said, well, there's where I got those words. He might be picking, JW's visiting all kinds of people. He's probably selecting what would be best for the radio show. So he's going to say, oh, these Squidbillies guys, they're entertaining. I'll use them. So I was constantly exploring and becoming human, so to speak, the human culture stuff. And I don't know where he got the rap, because JW didn't listen to rap. I don't think he had sons around, though. They might have been playing rap. They did all in the first year. But then Ion knew everything. Then later, he would start quoting, you know, obscure 50s TV. You've commented on that. And nobody we know knew that stuff.
Unless, say, something like Steve, he was born in the 40s, so he would have those TV shows in his head. So I could get it from him and all the other people who were baby boomers called in. So I was you know, scraping everybody's brains. Especially while, from talking to them. So that's a big thing to realize how I built up their repertoire. But eventually it got to the point where, well, they, I don't know how they got that stuff. Maybe they went somewhere else. Now, JW would be visiting different people and different businesses and that as a businessman through these years. So I picked up stuff from that. But now I think that I knew everything already. It seems that way. So because Bert and Chad are back doing the, going through the archives, and they're finding stuff said that's pretty obscure, but was said, and no one noticed it way back then. And they might mention the tech body back then, and then never developed it till 10 years later. So they planted a lot of stuff in the first couple of years that would be developed later. So that was their agenda, not stuff they were picking up from people. So, did you have another question about this thing? What were we talking about? Where JW was.
Kind of an eye on.
Where JW was.
Where JW was? I don't know. In the hospital?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't say when Susanna put her boat in, I didn't say whether it's right or not, but she said Mar-a-Lago.
Now, wasn't it revealed that JW was having health problems?
You don't know anything about what I'm going to tell you, so
Okay.
He's at Emory University, and he's taking the products. They've been watching him for years, and they don't understand the products. They don't understand that they measure his body, and he looks like he should be dead. Nothing's working right from regular medical knowledge. But they can't deny that he's very healthy in general, all energized. He's not sick at all. So they didn't understand that. Then after a while, they realized, oh, he's taking these products, which we don't know what they are, but they're doing something to him. And we found out from Ion that you take these our products, you start to, quote, ascend. It starts changing your body around. It has to change it because it's all fucked up under, you know, original sin conditions. They remove the original sin, and you start having a different body. And Ian told us way back then, if we went to a doctor, they get blood tested, you will be told by the doctor if something's screwed up in your blood. You ignore the, you say, yes, sir, yes, sir. You don't do anything about it because the blood is being changed by the product. And the doctors won't understand it. See, this is why this stuff is not, what is it called, rat's oil. What do people, when they put down stuff, rat poison, some slang word for meaning that it's a ripoff. It's not real what's claimed for it. Anyways, people said this is all crap. Well, it wouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. Now, a lot of injuries that you've had will be worked through. They'll come back. So Bert was in pain from his football and other stuff, Tai Chi, for years. You know, a lot of pain. But it got worked through, and now it's not there anymore. So so JW, his body was going, he purposely put himself in the hospital to get studied because he was getting evidence of what was going on with the products. He was using them. So we have that evidence. So then they gave him the three amino acids, or maybe just two of them. And they are phenomenal. They're the amino acids people had before they fell, before they got original sin. So if you put them in your body, you're going to get an amazing immortal body. You can cut your arm off, it'll grow back with this stuff. So,
and you're saying that Emerson gave him the two amino acids, correct?
Emory.
Emory, okay.
Yeah, you can look it up.
Yeah, well, JW gave it to him, said, okay, we have this. And he'd already softened them up with the earlier products, and they thought, well, that was interesting. Yeah, you get some more stuff? Yeah, here it is. And maybe they even had to make it. He told them how to take what he's giving them and make it extra. But I don't know about that part. And so they took them, and they looked at it, and maybe they put it in animals. I don't know what they would have done, but they got a little concerned. They said, this stuff is, like, powerful, but we don't understand it. So JW said his shoulders were getting, like, hit. Many years, 10 years or something, of bad shoulders, and they were getting worse. He couldn't even lift them up. So he said, I want to stop this stuff. Do your amino acids on the shoulders. So about a year ago, year and a half ago, summer of 23, I think, he started taking it. And the reaction, whatever was going on in his body, and they were measuring it, it scared the doctors. So they were going to do this, you know, procedure for a couple hours, and they stopped after 20 minutes. And that was a drag. It didn't get done. And it was going to be done in two shoulders, right? Two different efforts. So after a couple of days, JW's shoulder was all better. And they couldn't believe it because they didn't finish the process they thought they had to do. So he could lift it up and it was not a problem. And so he said, okay, let's do the other one. They didn't do the other one for a while. I think they scheduled something a couple of months down the road. And then after another month, the left shoulder got better, even though they didn't do what the procedure on it, which I think meant a bit of cutting into his skin. So after 6 weeks, he was all better. So that showed the power of the amino acids. So they started studying that with the knowledge of what happened to JW. So they basically have decided to call it, these strange people come in, and maybe they have these bottles, but if they've got some kind of aches and pains, they're calling it ascension disease. Don't know where they got the phrase, maybe because JW said it or something, or sometimes talking to JW, they're talking to Ion, and nobody knows it. And JW sounds very smart, because Ion's talking. So that's a little sketchy outline of how... So then JW started to go through these other changes from the amino acids. He was being shot at. Remember, he got poisoned like five times, and his wife did too, but they got her to the hospital in time. And there were a lot of lucky breaks. And one time he died on the table in the surgery room. But somebody came in and put another JW on the table, and the doctors didn't notice it. They didn't notice that the body had been changed. So he used to have 12 bodies. Now he's only got six. So he's lost a few in these battles. And so he went underground completely 8 months ago or something. So I didn't get to talk to him for a few months. No Ion. And he was going through some kind of thing where he couldn't have a bowel movement. So his body was going through these changes, and that was uncomfortable for a while. If you call that illness, it's not regular illness. It's a byproduct of the amino acids. So that eventually got fixed. So JW was able to come back with a little more security around him, and that's why we've been able to do a few Ion shows. It's only because JW could surface a bit. So that's the explanation, Greg.
A lot to take into account.
Yeah. Like he takes incredible amounts of REMAG,
way beyond anybody else's capacity to take them. You know, he takes a lot of the products in great amounts.
Well, he phones support.
Beg your pardon?
Right.
He phones support.
No, he didn't. He
didn't
call anybody. No, he didn't. He knows. He's got Ion. He can talk to Ion.
Oh, yeah. That's the best support you can get.
Yeah. See, so how does he talk to Ion if he's unconscious? Well, after the session, when he's unconscious and Ion's talking to somebody, then Ion removes himself, their selves, and JW is now normal. After a day or so, he starts downloading the content that Ion was saying to somebody. And then eventually he gets to hear, remember what was said. But it takes a day or two.
Well, it makes things complicated.
Oh, yeah. He's got the most. He's in so many. And he also travels around different realms. And he's going to the mountain. And that's a weird place. A couple of years ago, he says, I don't know where I am, Bob, what day it is. There's no time, nothing. I don't try to calibrate. I don't use my mind to figure out where I am. And somehow he takes instructions on what to do somehow without knowing what's going on in terms of normal, what, where, when, why. What, when, where, why, how, and where?
When.
Where.
When.
What, when, where, when. Why, how. Yeah. When. What, when, where, why, how.
When. And when.
Then a different word.
Yeah.
Not a W. Unless there is. What, when, where, why. How. It's five. Anyways, so it's been very strange for him. He sees everything happening all the time. Everything. That's overloading. He tries to keep it organized. Now, the only person he can talk to is me. I'm the only one that understands what he's going through and can hear his puzzling about it and say things about it. And because I hear what he says, then I don't know what's going on. But I can do office hours and devolve to a normal conversation and get out of the Ion space, so to speak. And get oriented a bit more. I'm not as extreme as JW, but so JW doesn't know. So we find out what to know, what's going on, by having Ion tell us. Ion can talk about it, but has said over the last couple of years, it's all getting
Bob,
pretty
you
blurred.
You find out what's going on. We don't find out anything. Not a single question was answered today.
I know. That's why I don't like him coming on office hours, because he gets agitated by Greg or Brian or Clinton, and he gets silly. So I was going to just let him on for like 10, 15 minutes and then mute him, and that's it. That's time to go away. But then Brian wanted him on. Brian liked him. So Brian, put up with abuse for half an hour or something, 45 minutes. But it's very... I'm used to it, but it's kind of complex. Staying in touch with JW and tuned into him and, quote, helping him understand what he's not going to be able to understand.
When you say that Brian wants him on, do you understand Stockholm Syndrome and the basic fundamental concepts of bullying?
Oh, yeah. I know about bullying. I find it quite hilarious the way Ion does it. Because I know Ion loves you guys more than you ever know, because it's not human. He's got the love power, or whatever it is, it's non-physical. He's zapping everybody with love. With some kind of energies, which are not physical. He could do all kinds of things to people. And he kept it down to, a balanced or modest level in the first few years, and everybody loved Ion. They thought he was the most loving voice going. But then Ion knew that they had to toughen everybody up and get ready for what was happening. So Ion got a little harsher when he came back in 2014 after a couple of years break. He was different. And then he got more hectic, and then he talked more, and then he told all this crazy scenario. Now, what's incredible tonight is that he said Susanna's not here, but maybe you heard it. Somebody here heard it. I think he said Andromeda is happening within 5 years. Anybody hear that?
Yeah.
You heard it.
No.
Did Brian hear it? Brian's on mute.
I don't have the ability to understand timelines that are linear, so that basically just means nothing to me.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we don't know what I means by 5 years. He knows we mean something, you know, a human level. Most people are linear, so they'll take that. But there's other levels that I'm talking about. So we don't know what he said, but it was crazy, because in the Bible it says when Jesus comes back, there's 1,000 years of, Nelson used to tell me this stuff, there's 1,000 years of peace. And the chosen ones are the administrators in the global government in the time of peace. So I asked Stein once, that Herbert Armstrong scenario, is that what it is, 1,000 years? They said, no, it's shorter than that. That's not accurate. So that was all ahead. It was shorter than that. So then we think of this hard times we're going to go through. The dust settles from it, and then there's 28 nations or empires left, and we'll be the top nation power, and we'll bring in all this great stuff, and it'll be a great environment for a while. But I thought it would be more than 5 years, because the universe is changing, and that's why we have to go to Andromeda. The skies, the galaxies are going to collapse, which is all in the Book of Revelation. Nobody's understood what it was, but pretty dramatic, and I explained the drama. So I figure we're going to make this, why are we bringing forth Coldplay and all this stuff? Can't we get to use it for a couple of 100 years, you know, before we have to go? But to say 5 years, that's crazy. But on other levels, Ion is saying things have sped up. Been saying that for 6 months. Things are happening now that JW, because he sees a bit of the future through Ion, he says, I didn't see this stuff coming now. I thought it was happening 10, 20 years down the road. So it's very intense. The concluding remarks are, it's very intense. I can't go to the beach every day. I have to be, it has to be cleared. Somehow the people around me, the bodyguards, they can see what's going to happen the next day, which determines whether somebody will be able to get me. So we start off with something. You had a question about JW. Anybody remember what the first part of this conversation with Greg was? Was I asking Greg if he heard something?
You asked Greg, where is JW? And Greg said, I don't know, the hospital?
Why would I ask Greg where JW? Oh, yeah, rhetorically I was asking that. That's right. Yeah, I wanted to see what he picked up at a hospital. So, Greg, you're free to talk about whatever you want to talk about. How come the government hasn't fallen in Canada?
Well, I guess the thing is that they're off on holiday.
Oh yeah, that'd be a Christmas break, right?
So everybody, like on all these YouTube channels, everybody's going, you know, he should resign, Trudeau should resign, should resign. And I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm beginning to sort of be a, I know this sounds strange, but I'm sort of almost rooting for Trudeau at this point. But but only because I want him to, but I don't you know, I don't have any faith in him to do the kind of revenge that I want him to do on people like Freeland and these other Ukrainians that are in his, that are MPs. So this, yeah, there's this other Toronto Ukrainian who's a member of parliament, and he went on to CPV and he's calling for Trudeau to resign. Meanwhile, a little over a year ago, this Ukrainian is standing there with Trudeau as Trudeau is giving a speech that you might expect Adolf Hitler to have given in a style of Adolf Hitler. I could send you the video. And
is this because of the convoy, that era?
No. It's about Ukraine. Trudeau came to Toronto to do a pep talk to the Ukrainians. This would have been in maybe a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. And this Ukrainian MP is standing behind Trudeau and obviously very happy that Trudeau's there.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going on to the major network. Remember, he's in the government. He's a liberal in the government. And he's going on television saying that Trudeau should resign.
Why?
So, because everybody, you know, they want to get on the bandwagon. Everybody hates Trudeau. So, even his own party, even the people in his own party want him gone. Now, of course, I think these Ukrainians are thinking that they can get Freeland in as the liberal leader and maybe somehow she'll be able to salvage something, and then yep, they'll have a Ukrainian, maybe not as prime minister, but who knows. And that this guy in Toronto, I mean, I saw something on a YouTube channel tonight, and they had a poll, and they'd done some polling, and they figured out how many seats in Parliament the Liberals would retain all over Canada if an election were held now. And the answer was 6. Now that's 6 out of well over 350 seats. How many seats in Parliament in Canada? There are 338 seats. So the way that it would play out, according to this poll, is that the Liberals, who are now now have a minority government, but they would go down to from. Let me see how many seats do the Liberals have. Liberals in Parliament in Canada. 153. So they would go from 153 to 6. Now,
Greg, announced the conference is now locked.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. I get the.
It's now unlocked.
Classic example of a pocket dial or something. I accidentally hit that button.
It's Brian. Brian did it. Brian turns on recordings, off recordings. from time to time. I mean, not so much now as in the past. But
I'm getting better at
Brian does things with this Turbo Bridge board that none of us know how to do.
Yeah. My mistake. So, Brian, what's it mean that it's been locked? What's that mean?
If I tried to lock
it, I guess maybe it means no one else can join.
If I tried to do that now, I couldn't do it.
Really?
And maybe Brian couldn't do it either.
It's just one of the buttons here. It's like next to the near the unmute button.
Okay. Presentation. No.
There
it is. Security. Security.
Star,
locked and unlocked.
And
I get it. I see.
Turbo Bridge, super easy.
Yeah. Well.
Okay, carry on about Trudeau.
So 153 to 6. He canceled almost all but one of his yearly meetings with the media. Usually he would go to the various media and then they would interview him at the end of the year.
Yeah.
He canceled everything except this hour has 22 minutes, which is a sort of a comedy program about current affairs.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. Yeah. And so one of the people who I guess is still on that show did an interview with him. I mean, the guy's name is Mark Critch, for those that care. And so he's doing this interview. It's heavily edited for time and for content, perhaps. And one of the parts of the interview was that they were giving Trudeau a present. And it was a banner. And they're unfurling the banner. And during that whole convoy thing, trucker convoy, a banner was created where it had on it, I'll spell it out, F, then the maple leaf, then CK, and then below it, Trudeau.
Mm.
Okay? So they started unfurling this thing, and it says, you see the CK and the dough of Trudeau. And Trudeau starts getting nervous about what's going to happen. And so this is going to be broadcast on the CBC, right? So they unfurl it and it says, good luck, Trudeau. Something like that.
Yeah.
And luck is spelled L, and then a maple leaf. CK.
Yeah.
So, and then of course Trudeau is relieved. And so that was the only interview that he did for the media, and it was with the CBC. Now, at this point, I figure hardly anybody is watching the CBC. So, and those that insist upon watching it are probably NDP and Liberal people. And Trudeau called himself a progressive. He put himself in the same camp as the NDP, as progressives. We're progressives. Now, what I think if he had, I mean, I'm hoping. Now, okay, I'll go through a bit of the process here. And I've done it recently, actually. I've gone out and had to do this. I mean, I didn't have to do it. I agreed to do it. In order to get on the ballot, in Canada, in a particular riding, you are required to go and get 100 signatures of residents in that riding who are eligible to vote. So, and they have to give their name, address, postal code, and they have to sign the thing. And remember, they have to be a citizen. They can't be a landed immigrant or anything like that, or a refugee or whatever the case is. So in the last couple of two or three weeks, I've gone out on several occasions and gone door to door in apartment buildings. And solicited signatures of people who will agree that a person that I suppose I'm advocating for, that they'll allow them to be on the ballot, that they'll agree that they can be on the ballot. They don't have to vote for them. They're not signing and saying, oh, I'm going to support this person. They're just saying that they'll be allowed to be on the ballot. So, and the Marxist-Leninist Party has to, you know, in a riding, typically, I mean, we won't even get 100 votes. So we have to get 100 signatures to get on the ballot. So it means that when we, even when we're going and doing that, like people will sign it and they're not, they have no interest in voting for us. Like, but that's part of the deal. Like they're just saying, oh yeah, okay, we'll allow you to be on the ballot. And sometimes I don't even get into whether it's Marxist-Leninist or not. I just go and say, this guy wants to be on the ballot or this woman wants to be on the ballot. And, in order to be on the ballot, they have to find someone who agrees that they be on the ballot. So I'm saying, so the reason I'm mentioning that is because everyone has to do that. Like, let's say you're a member of parliament, sitting member of parliament, like these Ukrainians in Toronto, these two, Freeland and this other jerk who's a member of parliament. They have to present to Elections Canada some paperwork with 100 signatures on it. Now, that's not going to be hard for them to do. They're not going to go door to door. They're just going to get it done within the party. But the reason when I go around with these papers for the Marxist-Leninists, it's already been decided who's going to be the candidate. The party has already decided so-and-so is running in that riding, right? It's all decided. However, in the various other parties, it may be a foregone conclusion that, let's say, Chrystia Freeland, who is presently the member of parliament, that it may be a foregone conclusion that the local riding committee will nominate her. She will have there'll be nobody running against her, and they'll just nominate her, and then they'll just, you know, write out the signatures that day and have them ready for Elections Canada, you know, because, I mean, they have tens of thousands of people voting for them, or, you know, over 10,000 people voting for them in a riding. So, and even the riding association would have probably enough people going to the meeting that they could just sign them right there and get it over with. So, but here's the thing. What if the Liberal Party gets somebody else to run against Freeland at the riding level, within the Liberal Party riding level, and starts challenging her for the nomination in that riding? And similarly, this guy who's going out and saying, oh, Trudeau has to resign. Well, what happens if Trudeau goes, wait a minute, we don't want that guy in there. Let's get somebody else in there. We'll get some challengers in there, and we'll see whether we can beat that guy at the nomination level. Because this guy's, he's a traitor. He's going against me. So, I mean, that's what I would do if I were Trudeau and I was the leader of the Liberal Party. I'd say, you know, hell, I'm going to run. I'm going to run in the election. I don't care whether I'm going to go down to 6 seats. I'm running. But these people who ran against me, I'm going to get rid of them. You were against me? Okay, well, why? I'm the leader. You just said I have to resign. You leave. We'll get somebody else. And then they get that person nominated in the riding. Okay, they're going to lose, probably. But that other person probably would have lost, too. So that's what I'm hoping that Trudeau does. I mean, I know. I mean, I don't like Trudeau. I don't like Trudeau at all. But I'm concerned about these Ukrainians, and that they're gonna. I think they see that, even though they know they're gonna lose, I think they see this as an opportunity to take over the Liberal Party, to have it almost a completely Ukrainian-run Liberal Party, if it isn't already. And I'm sure these Sikhs that I know are involved in the Liberal Party, we haven't heard too much from them, but they may be looking at it and going, oh, we'll take over the Liberal Party. So my impression is that I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think that Trudeau is going to, I think he's going to run in the next election. And as much as everybody's going around saying, oh, he should resign or he's going to resign, I don't think so. I think he's going to carry on and go down with the ship and take out the people who were, who stabbed in the back, presumably, if that's what happened. I mean, if that actually occurred. And it isn't just some kind of plan, organized plan by the Liberal Party. But and also evidently Trudeau can go back, and when they go back into Parliament in late January, Trudeau can pull a thing called proroguing. He can prorogue Parliament. Now, I don't know exactly how that's done, but the effect of it is that Parliament is sort of suspended for a period of time and nothing happens, but it just delays things. And Stephen Harper, who was the leader of the Conservative Party, I believe that he pulled that routine and because he thought that there might be a no confidence vote or something and that he might lose.
Yes.
And he pulled that trick. So, and the Liberals have gone on and on about how, you know, most, you know, you guys prorogue Parliament, and they sort of chastised them for what had been done before. But there's commentary that could happen again. But I think it has to be agreed to by the Governor General, but, you know. I mean, that could happen. It happened before. So there's precedent. There's a precedent for it. So I think it just gives the Liberals a longer period of time to form a fear campaign about the Conservatives to say, and Trudeau sort of did it in this interview today to a certain extent, by saying, oh, the NDP and us, we're progressives. And so I think that they'll just do the usual thing where they'll demonize the Conservative Party in any way that they can reasonably, for them, do it. And now, you know, lately, Poilievre, the leader of the Conservatives, has come out as a very staunch Zionist, saying really the most terrible things. Now, and I think he can do that because I think he thinks that the Liberals won't chastise him about it because they don't want to anger the Zionist community in Canada. So he's got carte blanche to do whatever he wants to there. Will the Liberals decide to demonize him for these type of words? I don't know, doubtful. But they might use any trick in the book because they're going to go down so hard, apparently. But I have a feeling that things will moderate if given enough time. People will just forget about it. They'll see Trudeau out there. There was a video that circulated because Trudeau went out to British Columbia to go skiing in the last week. And it was kind of a secret he was out there. And then there was footage showing him out there. And then a woman walked up to Trudeau and said, Mr. Prime Minister. And Trudeau turns around and says, oh, yes, hello. And he's all in his ski outfit. He just got off a run, and he's sort of a little bit out of breath, and he looks cold there. Anyway, he walks over to the woman. He extends his hand, and the woman says something like, she says, oh, get the fuck out of British Columbia, and then says, you suck. And Trudeau says, oh, have a nice day, man, and turns and walks away. Now, this was heavily circulated, and at least in the YouTube I don't know what happened in the mainstream. I don't watch it. But I thought that, I mean, again, it might sound like I'm getting soft on Trudeau, but I thought that it was, I just thought it was rude in any event. It'd be one thing if you went up to him and he had something, I mean, more, something about an issue, some political issue that you might talk about. But just to go up to him and say, you know, get the, like, talk to him. I mean, if we see Trudeau, if we say that he is a Canadian, which I suppose he is, to go up to another Canadian and tell them to get the fuck out of a province, I don't know, that's a slippery slope to start doing things like that. I mean, no matter what, how much distaste you might have for the Prime Minister, I think
it's not. It's not any kind of a righteous expression, and it actually just hands him an opportunity to turn it into a win by just him being polite, like he did, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Good. You know, it's hard for me to say that they planned that was a planned thing by the Liberal Party, but yeah, it just and we were watching a woman who does that we've been watching lately, who does a political thing on YouTube, and yeah, she said more or less what I said after I had said it to Catherine, how I said, well, you know, I don't like Trudeau, but I thought that was really kind of ugly, what went on there, and that's not a good thing. So again, it would be a little bit different if they were talking to him about some issue or another where they had some knowledge about something or a position. Some kind of position about a particular topic, but just to tell somebody to get out of, you know, Canadian province. Oh, and to say that to the Prime Minister, I mean, in any event, that's not good. That's an ugly thing to do. And, you know, that's coming from someone. I mean, I've been out protesting against Trudeau. You know, I've never got up close to him or anything, but, I'm not sure what I would do if I got up close to it, but you know, I mean, I've gone out there, but I haven't done things like that. So, but there's an ugly, you know, there's a lot of, and it's partisan as well, right? You have people who are Conservative Party people who maybe, I don't know this woman that did this. I have no idea who they are and why, what they're thinking. But it's very partisan, of course, like it is in the United States, like it is anywhere pretty much. The people, generally the people on YouTube that do political things, they're pro-conservative. They're openly partisan. They can't help. They can't help it. Even the ones that are even sort of somewhat fair about it are conservatives, because that's the only other alternative. Because Trudeau is so analogous with the NDP. That there's really, if you just look at it, that it's the NDP, the Liberals, Conservatives, and, well, maybe the Green Party. Well, there's not much choice, really. I mean, it's always been that way, though. Nothing new. It's like in America. I mean, if anybody's listening here from the United States, when I talked about going and getting those signatures, I mean, it must seem downright primitive to Americans, because You can't get on the ballot in America doing that. I mean, you have to turn, heaven upside down to start to get on a ballot in America. I mean, you have to get tens of hundreds of thousands of signatures or something, right? It's as far as I know, as far as what I've heard, and then the other political parties just do, they'll do anything to stop people from getting on the ballot. Whereas, you know, I was going around and there was a man who came to the door and I told him about it. And he says, "What? No, people have never seen this. We're the only ones that go." Well, I mean, I don't know we're the only ones, but it's very unusual for the big parties don't go around apartment block by apartment block, you know, door to door, getting nomination signatures. They just don't do it. They don't have to do it. But the smaller parties, well, they have to because their network is smaller. And so this one guy said to me, "Says, do you mean to?" After I explained it a few times, he says, "Do you mean to say I could get on the ballot?" And I go, "Yeah, you could. If you went around and got 100 signatures, you could get on the ballot." He goes, "Oh, can I have one of those pieces of paper?" And I go, "Okay, here." I gave him a sample. It's from Elections Canada. You can download them. And he goes, "Oh, okay, all right." Will he do it? I don't know. But it's possible. I mean, we went out. It seemed when I start out, I think, "Oh my God, going door to door, you know, people are gonna, you know, they'll be angry or they'll be this or that," and you know, I kind of dread it actually having to do it. But you know, you go out and do it, and it's surprising. And one of the guys that I went out with, one of the, you know, I usually go out and in a little team of people, either a couple of you or four of you or something. And I was surprised how many people that were like communist leaning as we went door to door. And I mentioned that to him, and he says, "Yeah, it's surprising, isn't it?" He says, "There are a lot more communists than you'd think. It's just that they, the ones that you do meet that sort of express cautiously some sort of pro-communist leanings, they are surprised there's a party. They go, 'There's a party? There's a communist party here?'" Like, I said, "Yeah." I said, "There's been one for there are two of them. There are two communist parties. This, this candidate wants to be in is, well, you know, it's been around for 55 years. And the other one's been around for maybe 100. And nobody, you know, people go, "Oh, I didn't know." So people are uninformed about what's going on, because the media just concentrates on the big parties, and that's where all the money is. So, anyway, I don't know if there's much more to say about it. It's just Trudeau appears to be in trouble, and the other party appears, the Conservative Party appears to be on their way. If things would go down as the election occurs now, they would get a vast majority. It would be somewhat, I mean, I wouldn't say it's similar to what happened in the United States with Trump, but for all intents and purposes, yes. I mean, basically, when Trump becomes president, well, kind of like here, if you get a majority government, the other parties are useless. They can't do anything. They can't go against you. In fact, Trump has probably less power in the United States, because you can see that coming up now, is that they're saying, well, you know, the Congress is going to stop him doing this and stop him doing that, and they're going to get in his way on this and that and so on and so forth. You know, when they're running for president, it just seems like, oh, if they get the presidency, they're going to be able to do whatever they want. He's going to have, you know, be able to have concentration camps and enslave everybody. And then when the dust settles, they kind of go, "Oh, well, you know, not really going to be able to do that much. He's going to get he's going to get stopped by this person or that person or whatever. So in Canada, I think when you get a majority government, well, that's pretty serious power. You can pretty much do whatever you want because nobody can get in your way. You put a bill through the parliament and it's going to fly through. It's going to go through parliament. It has to go through the Senate. You might encounter some flack there, but I don't know. Are you eating, Bob? Having something to eat? I hear noises at Bob's end. There's something. What is it? I'm gonna turn my thing up. Let's take this. Sounds sort of like food preparation to me. Can't quite place it, though.
Yeah, curious sound.
Yeah, there's something going on. Okay, so what's going on the chat lines? Let's see. Snake oil, Bob. Was he starting with the real line? Is the lansoprene slows down metabolism with alkaline awful? That's evidently from Robert. Stephanie said tough love. Robert in Tottenham says, or it's Robert Tottenham. True, with a blue heart. And Sarah put participant keypad command. She's doing some Turbo Bridge stuff. Can't really see it though. I tried to enlarge it. What is it? Play.
If you go to the Turbo Bridge website, it'll tell you what your codes are because as a host, yours are different.
Oh yeah, I see. Oh, are they? Okay.
I
raise your hand.
You might
start
be able
five.
To use these as a participant who's a host too. I'm not sure because I've never seen it from that end.
Move into sub. Yeah, I'm sure you can. We can do lots of amazing. Is there anything in there that looks interesting that we could do? Oh, I see. Okay. I've enlarged it.
Yeah.
I can promote people to be a host.
Right.
Can mute my line. Toggle on and off. That's interesting. Roll call private announcement. Turn off hold music. Okay, well, I don't get into that. More decrease speaking volume. Increase listening volume. Increase speaking volume. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I've known how to unmute myself for years, and I think Bob thinks that I don't know. He mutes me all the time, and it's really bizarre to me because I could unmute myself, and I'm just respectful instead.
Can you? You can unmute yourself.
Yeah, I can also. Yeah, I can. Yes, I can.
I thought only a host could do that.
Yeah, but there's phone freaking, not hard. And there's just a lot of information about how to do simple things like that with TurboBridge.
That's interesting, the increased speaking volume and decreased speaking volume. That's interesting, because remember last week I was talking about, was it Ned? or he was always like on my end. He was extremely loud, and Bob was very low. And I, of course, I don't know how I'm coming off compared to everybody else, but that would be a way to mitigate that, right?
Absolutely.
You can do it within the stripper bridge, so you can get everybody's volume levels at a. I mean, if you did testing, you'd have to increase listening volume, decrease listening. Well, I can do that just, you know, with. Well, it's very interesting. Yeah, I don't think we don't know enough about those things. Robert also says, do need speak to speak with Croker to bring him up to speed, as well as patch him in with Bob, Ion, and Greg. Do needs to speak with Croker, too. Now, this is a common thing that has been talked about, is getting Croker involved. And that I, in particular, because I'm going out to British Columbia on occasion, that somehow that I meet up with Croker, but that's easier said than done. There's nothing to say that Croker would, and what would I say to Croker? I don't know anything about him, really. I mean, everything I know about him is about through Bob. And it's one thing when you get to meet somebody and maybe Brian would be better at meeting Croker than I would. I'm sort of assuming that Brian knows a lot about Croker, which I guess he does. I don't know anything about him. I don't even understand what there's, you know, I've heard things, but I don't understand what his whole scene is.
I suppose you could go to Bob's charts, like the Holy Offices, and probably just kind of fake it from there if you had that as a visual prompt.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be going in there and saying, oh, I don't really know who you are, but I know a guy who talks about you all the time.
Yeah. Buzzwords. Just drop in all the buzzwords.
And also I know an entity. He's not real. He's an entity. His name's Ion, and he talks about you sometimes. He brings your name up. And that particular entity, well, maybe I shouldn't say this, but he's talked to your wife after she died.
Right.
Somehow I don't think that whole conversation would go very well.
No, it doesn't. I talked to William Irwin Thompson for a little while, and it didn't go well at all.
Which was this? What?
Bob's like, he puts him in the teacher role, is it? Thompson might be artist, maybe. I don't know. I have to look at Bob's stuff. But, yeah, no, I approached him, and then, it didn't go well to bring up the Canadian Bob Dobbs and Ion.
Who did you do that with?
Oh, okay, William Irwin Thompson.
Oh, you did that? You actually talked to the guy?
Well, email.
Oh, email. Yeah. You actually emailed the guy.
Yeah, I've got an email going with Reverend Stang right now, actually.
And did you actually bring Bob Dobbs up, the Canadian Bob Dobbs?
Oh, I always do. Yeah.
And do they get completely incensed?
I mean, no. Well, I don't know. Not
or do they
really.
Get? Or are they just confused?
They politely fade out, maybe. Like, sometimes they'll get mad and irritated, but that's if they have a particular experience to be mad about. Otherwise, they'll just kind of be like, and kind of stop responding.
Like, would you say to William Irwin Thompson, would you say, oh, I'm very involved, I know a lot about the Thompson Quadrant. Like,
I would just say, like, what I said was, okay, so I met someone who is proclaiming to be able to teach about you, but they consider you to be the best teacher. I'm curious how you feel about that. Also, if I wanted to study your lexicon, where would you suggest beginning? That was like the first email. So then he was like, talked back and forth about where to go in his archive, kind of.
Right.
And then eventually was like, oh, by the way, who said that? Like, address the other part of the email. And I'm like, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, bye.
And do you think the guy knows? He knows who Bob is?
I don't know. I mean, Well, I mean, Stang does, for sure. I don't know. You should ask Bob that, if William Irwin Thompson would know him. But he's deceased anyway, so of course he can be beckoned if Ion's present, Greg. We can ask him.
Well, I guess the person that would know what William Irwin Thompson thinks is William Irwin Thompson, but then again,
right.
Do you really want to ask the guy?
Well, because the only way to do that would be if a medium could channel him in the afterlife.
Yeah, so yeah, he'd have to die.
But he is dead. And
oh, he is
that's
dead.
What I'm saying. Yeah,
well,
that's what I'm saying. So, like, yeah, we can't address it at this point. This was before he died.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's dead. Okay. So
yeah.
Okay. Well, you'd think Ion would just go and do that, wouldn't he?
Yep, that's if you suspend your disbelief, then I can say yes. Ion has the ability to contact him and answer all of our questions about it. But for me, a more interesting question would be, can Ion channel the living?
Interesting idea.
That's the kind of question, that I would expect you could find the answer in the handbook for the recently deceased.
Right, or the book of going forth by day, the Egyptian, what is it, the Emerald Tablet?
Oh yeah, I'm thinking of the book from Beetlejuice, though. Yeah, but that's a good question. Can you channel the living?
I think Bob's trying to channel someone right now.
Yep, I'm working on it. Preparing my script that I will memorize and then make you ask the questions.
Yeah, I was talking about that with Catherine. The whole idea of asking people questions, that's an interesting concept because it carries with it several possible scenarios. One of them is that it's you're sort of putting yourself at a lower attitude to another person. You're saying, I'm going to be the questioner and you've got all the answers. There's that. Right? And
yeah.
Then there's the idea that you're questioning somebody because you know for sure you've seen them do something that you want to do or you want details about having to do something, and then you're not really being subordinate. You're just keen to find out something. Now, so that's kind of like Bert, I think. Bert, it's hard to know what his agenda is, but.
Yeah, you got an agenda, man.
I don't know what his agenda is. But I mean, it could be viewed that he's actually saying, you know, if I mix this product with that product and mix in some other stuff, put some honey in there, and, you know, is that gonna help my hippocampus or whatever?
And you reminded me, you know what happened to Brian tonight when I was here? It essayed to them, I guess, with this sinister tone. We know where you live, Brian. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear that.
Brian takes the traditional medium conversation to new levels of push and pull and attack. But yeah, he was saying, we know where you live, Brian.
Well, I related to Brian in the sense that he's sort of being bullied into asking a question, coming up with something, but then it has to be a question that's acceptable to either first to maybe even you, Bob, and then to Ion. and it gets to almost to the point that it's impossible to even form a question. And you start to think, why am I even asking him anything? Like, what do I want to ask him something? Do I really want to do this? And why do I think he's an authority about anything?
Well, you know where that's, you know, there's a reason. People take our products. They're interesting. They get rid of their problems. And they want to know where it comes from. So iron's part of the process. So they say, well, let's talk to this thing that made this medicine that saved my life. That's how it started.
But they want to know, they want to know what, sometimes people phone, you know, get in touch with Ion and want to know what to do with their cat.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, or what political party is going to win, or you know, how much Bitcoin is going to be, and things like that. I mean, they're really broad topics. It's not.
Oh yeah, and it's built up. It's been going on for 32,000 hours.
Yeah, you got like Chad asking Ion.
Yeah.
They're going, I mean, long sessions. Going about Forex and things like that. And it gives the impression when that happens that Ion knows everything. There's nothing that he doesn't know. There's nothing that Ion would be curious about except Catherine. Like, it's the only thing that he seems to be curious about. He wants to somehow get in conversation with Catherine. He wants to ask Catherine questions or, but maybe even if he got Catherine on the line, he'd be demanding that she ask him questions. But and what's the other one? The other one is when you go to see a member of parliament, like you go to one of these candidates things and candidates meetings and, you know, you're probably going to ask questions of the people that you dislike the most. And you're trying to formulate something because no one wants to go to one of those things and ask a question. That's not good enough because you're never going to get, the question will be answered. Then you will, then it's going to go to the next person. You're not going to have a chance to even say anything, to even comment on the answer. So what people do when they go to those meetings, they get into a long statement. They want to make a statement. They've come there to make a statement. They're not interested in asking a question at all, to the point that almost everybody that stands up, and they all say, the ones that want to make the statement say, I'm going to be brief. And they're not brief at all.
Mm.
They'll go on for minutes if they were allowed to. Then the moderator comes and says, what's the question? And what is the question? Like, they don't want to get to the question. They just want to make a protracted statement. Because, again, you're lowering yourself when you go to one of those things and you're just saying, can you tell me this or whatever? And, you know, you're like begging and you're groveling to get an answer to something. People don't want to be put in that position. They want to go out. They want to be empowered. They want to be, and if they do have a question, a short one, it's going to be like a gotcha question. They don't like the person they're asking the question of. They want to formulate something that's, they've really put some thought and effort into it. It's going to be something that's going to get a laugh, or it's going to put them on the spot, or something. So questioning comes in all manners, being setting up that dynamic of where someone is in authority. I mean, that's essentially Ion is in authority. And when member of parliament or a candidate, they're in authority because you're not a candidate and they are. You're just someone who's there going to put an X beside a name. It's, and I, you know, you could go on to all kinds of dynamics that we live with. It's very unusual, although, I mean, it happens that you're actually asking a question where someone has the knowledge to give you the answer. And you want it. You want that answer. And I guess Bert, sometimes I think Bert's challenging Ion.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, sometimes he'll say, you know, I was listening and you said this. And then he won't say that Ion is contradicting himself, but he'll sort of suggest that maybe Ion is playing both sides of the road, right?
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure because Bert's kind of diplomatic.
Yep.
It was interesting also when Ion was saying, oh, we can give Bert a call. Well, we can call Bert now. Let's call Bert. He was, you know, oh, wake him up. But let's go ahead with Bert. I don't know why Ion just doesn't remotely get Bert to, like, while he's talking. He's just, like, through mind control or whatever, just get Bert to phone in.
He's done that.
Yeah, I know he's done that, but he didn't do that today.
No. Well, what I did, I emailed Bert. It's 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I said, well, he gets up early, so maybe he'll see this, and Ion's going to be here for a couple of hours, so he can come in. But Ion left, and Bert, I never heard back. Bert didn't respond. Let's see what he responded now. You know that Trevor Paul guy? You didn't. I got out the first birthday party yesterday. For some reason, somebody posted it. So I saw it, and I saw, oh, what's this? And so it's a birthday party. So I started watching it yesterday. And it's a 10-hour tape, and I've done about 6 hours. And there's a section, you're there. And it looked a little different. It's, well, to only 2 years, 3 years ago. And remember this, Trevor Paul from England, a Jamaican, he came on. And so I never went back and looked at the thing. So there were parts that I missed because I was doing something else. So for the first time, Trevor Paul's on there, and he's visible. And remember, we argued with him about whether we're racist, and he considered you racist, and Ion was extremely racist. Remember that guy?
Kind of.
Yeah, and it's very funny. And Trevor is not, he used to email me, call me a racist and all this. After I used to talk to him on the phone, and we had friendly conversations. All of a sudden, he turned on all of us and started to be racist. And he's all of a sudden he's there. We can see him, and he's all friendly. So I said, "Well, you know, everybody here is a racist, according to you." And so I said, "Let's go through it." And so I wanted to get him back to his anti-racist self.
And he ends up having an argument with you, Greg. And he concludes that you're a racist.
Yeah.
He says that Ion is the most racist of everybody there. And he said Brian was racist. And
yeah.
Maybe someone else. So I used to talk to him 10 years ago on the phone every now and then. Once a year. He's an interesting guy. He told me about what he worked at and his whole life there. Then he started calling me a racist, so he wouldn't talk to me. It seemed like he was serious. But this would have changed 3 years ago when he came on. Didn't expect him to be on there. And he was relatively friendly. But I'm seeing him for the first time yesterday. And so today, during the show, I get an email from him. I haven't had an email from him in over 10 years. And it says, Happy New Year. Hi, Bob. Hope that you are well. I've just moved once again. Please keep in touch. Love as always, Trevor/T. So, I guess after that, 3 years ago, he was friendly. We might have talked on the phone. But now it's 3 years later. But it's interesting. His being picked up on me looking at him yesterday.
Mm.
So he emailed me. And he didn't know I did that, as far as I know. Unless he's MI6 and got me under surveillance and knows that I did look at him yesterday.
Did he say, what? Do you remember why he... You were saying something about he had pictures of me or something.
No, we got to look at you.
Oh, he knew I was white.
Yeah, he saw everybody.
Yeah,
he was being all friendly. So I said, come on, be your old self. Who's racist here? You know what he eventually said, that Toronto was the most racist city in the world.
Was he from, is he from Canada?
No, he's from Jamaica. You know, he grew up
in Jamaica.
But, you know, he came there quite young. So he's a British Jamaican guy. In fact, I wonder if I could play 100th birthday. Could you hear this? Let's see if I can get the part with him and hear it. Did you hear Ion describe Jermaine's baby?
Has she bumped out a baby?
Yeah, she'll have a baby around February 22nd.
Oh, okay. Hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. So she's going to be an angel. Angel baby. Sure not.
Oh. Does that mean...
No humans are born anymore, Greg. Or nine. Oh. No more human babies. Last year, it's just been angel babies. And, Roxy knows that statement, and she's dealing with these 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds in school, and she says they're monsters, these kids. So she understands that they're angel babies. She has no problem with that idea because they're not like normal kids. They're really terrible. And one kid almost cut her finger off with scissors.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Ion told Jermaine that her baby was going to die if she didn't do exactly what they told her to do. Well, no, they said they would take her baby if Jack didn't do exactly what Ion said to do. And then Ion became extremely emotional. Greg, I've never heard Ion cry before.
Yeah, he started talking about the baby, got more into it, and he started crying while talking. Great.
Yeah. But you say that what, Bob? The angel babies are good?
Oh, no, they're bad.
Right.
I think they're going to die.
But Ion would be sad if they didn't survive?
Well, something special is going to happen with Jermaine's baby. And so it's very special. I think I heard him say this baby's going to be really, will really stand out. I mean, have a lot of... talents or something. So it's a major project. And so he was telling Jack and Jermaine they got to be real careful in how she's given birth. So I found the part with, so Greg, you know, I is it too late for you to get on your computer?
I'm on my computer right now.
Okay.
That's why I'm talking to you.
Right. So I would say I can send you the link. I'm going to post it.
All right.
And I see him showing up at 3 hours and 58 minutes. So let me just go like that and hear him and figure out how far back you go. You might like to see how you look. We'll just have to go with that. Okay, so I'm going to put the link in the chat line. And you can grab it and organize it. And we can listen to our conversation with him. It's quite entertaining, I think.
This was ages ago.
This was 3 years ago, my 100th birthday, February
2nd. Oh, right, I remember that.
Yeah, 2022. Robert tells me, just sent him the Evergreens interview with Cro-Magnon, man. Some snake oil. That's the word I was looking for. And Robert Tottenham came up with it. Okay, Greg, there's the chat line.
Right.
You're going to go to 3 hours and 55 minutes, say.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, 355.
Beg your pardon? What'd you say, Greg?
Okay, now how am I going to do this? Because this is a 10-hour video.
Yeah.
It's going to take too long to download it.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's
and then
a
I
problem,
have to, like I have to it'll take too long to download it, then I have to bring it
okay,
into
I'll,
the...
All right.
It's not
feasible. I'll phone in.
To get some
I'll
good
do it
quality sound.
Yeah, I'm going to phone in.
It's interesting. I'm talking... I mean, this is 3 years ago or so.
Yeah.
I'm talking about how the Conservative Party ousted their leader.
Yeah, yes, I...
Hold on, I
must
I'm,
have heard
I'm,
that. I must
off.
Have heard it.
What?
Yeah, it was interesting what people were saying. Okay, I'm going to call in, and then I'll just play it myself, okay?
All right, yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Greg, Greg, look how bored Al is. Look at Al's face.
So bored.
Where's Al? Hold on, I gotta find Al. Where is it? Al. Where's Al? Where's Al?
Very good.
I'm just Al's showing you myself. Look how bored well. You are, Al. Look how animated
That's
I am.
That's a single man, Greg.
Hey,
you can hear this.
So I've got to turn off something to get rid of the echo. To get rid of the boss.
Hello.
Line muted.
Hello.
Hello.
Logout. Hello. Can you hear me? I'm on, right? Can you hear me, Greg? Greg! How come you can't hear me? Can you hear me, Greg? Well, why can't this be heard? Can you hear me, Greg? Can you hear me, Greg? Hey. Hey, Linus, are you there? No one's there. Are you there, Sarah?
It's ChatGPT, an AI assistant. Our conversation may be reviewed for safety. How can I help you?
If I can did it again, Brian, you hit some button.
I'm sorry. Oh, it sounds like there might have been a misunderstanding. Could you clarify what you mean?
You hear that, Linus?
Yeah, what was that?
I don't know. Something's talking to me.
Clarify what you mean?
Yeah, I know. Some voice. Some, you know, tech body voice. I think you triggered something. Because you just came in. So.
Yeah.
Yes?
Somebody,
what's on your mind?
Listen to that. Bob, what's on your mind?
Oh, God, it's like some weird Alexa or something.
Yeah. What's on my mind? Nothing.
Well,
no,
what's
on your mind?
That's what I can do.
Absolutely.
You did it, Sarah?
Boom. Yes.
What did
Got
you
it.
Do?
I'm here to help. Did you have a specific question or task in mind?
Shut up.
Sure thing. What's up?
Can you hear it, Brian?
My guidelines won't let me help with that.
Jesus Christ. Brian gets knocked out.
Oh, dear.
What are you doing, Brian?
You know, my internet connection likes to cut out sometimes.
Yeah, it's doing that. But you're still here. There was two Linuses.
Wait,
so, Greg... Where's Greg?
It should only be one.
Yeah.
Yeah, how's it going there, Bob?
Okay, you ready to listen?
All right, yeah.
What?
Yes, yes, I'm ready.
Okay.
I'll bring it up here. And it's at 350. I just listened to it for a while. I'll ask you what you think of it. So I got to go over to the phone.
You play a little bit of it and see whether how understandable it is.
Okay, I can hear you. Now, what's weird, can you speak, Greg?
Yes, I can. Hello?
Coming through. I think I got to turn the headphones off, the web call. Because you can't hear me.
Yeah, maybe. But I can mute you, can't I? I can mute you.
Oh, and then what?
There it is.
No, it's quite loud. Here we go.
No, that's
Macintosh instructions for cripples.
I know, but I'm asking Yuri to remind me how to find
the control key. So
I've got to get rid of the whole fucking
web
call thing. Log out. Now, there should be no echo.
All right.
Yeah, hold down the control key on the keyboard, yes.
And then what?
No, you're not on the Mac, Greg. It doesn't look...
There he is.
Fucking technical difficulty.
You've never seen Trevor before. Yeah, here Trevor comes in. See if you can hear this.
Hey, Brandon.
It's a little bit broken. Is it?
So how
technical?
Long ago did you start
that's
that?
Better. That's better.
When did you start that,
It's loud enough, right?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. I mean, we're louder than that. Yeah, we're louder than it is, but okay.
Yeah.
Piece that you're working on now.
A couple months ago.
Very nice.
What material is it?
We're talking to Brendan, the sculptor.
Can you hear me?
Hey, look at the cat.
Yeah.
Look at the cat.
Whoa, someone from Ottawa just called in. Hello, Ottawa friend.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
You know the whole 22 thing? Like, this
is
the ultimate 22 day, right? Obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, the leader of the Conservative Party today was ousted in Canada.
Yeah, the leader of the Federal Conservative Party.
I don't think Bob has got that news yet.
Yeah. So,
I know the guy. On a full-on 22.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
How did they oust him? What did they do?
They got together and voted. They just said, oh, we've got enough votes, and they voted, and he's out. But they chose a 22 to do it. I think it might have happened last night, but...
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
It was announced today.
Right, so pressing control, I can't bring up the place where it says non-participants. Where? How do you click that on?
613.
Here.
That's another one number, yeah. Someone from Ottawa just called in on the phone.
Hey, Clinton, how do I get to non-participants? Where is that up there in the north?
What Yuri told you to do. Hold down control key and then click on somewhere on the video screen.
Oh, yeah. That's why I wanted to get off the – that's why I wanted to get to the empty space. That was the reason. Yeah. So
okay.
You don't – you don't have any non – you can't see any of the non-participants right now. Correct, Bob?
Whatever.
You don't have anything to click on right now.
I can see Kim. Okay, I hit Kim. Oh, there it is. So I have to hit on hide non-video. Okay, I think I got it now. Yes, yeah. Okay, sorry. Anyway, so back to, what's it mean, James, when people are, they're saying waiting room? Oh, because we've got maximum people here? But why
no, that's just room? Where they are. When you first join, I have to hit accept, and they say it's a waiting room.
Hey, look at that. Trevor. We've never seen Trevor before.
That's beautiful, Yuri.
Okay, can you hear that, Greg? We've never seen Trevor before. Do you hear that? Greg. Linus.
I hear it.
Okay. Did Greg hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll come to the point. We're going to interact with Trevor. I've never seen him before. Here we go.
Cool, Yuri. How'd you do that?
Oh, let me snatch your picture and I'll show you.
Trevor. We've never seen Trevor before. The fucking Nazi ass, the asshole racist.
What? Look at him. What?
That's Trevor. T. That's T.
Hey.
Look at T.
Trevor. Trevor. Whoa.
Anybody had
welcome
a fight with Trevor?
Trevor.
Hey,
Trevor hates Bert. He, boy, does he hate Bert.
What's up, my dad?
It looks like he did an institution, like you're at work, Trevor? Yeah, looks at work environment.
I think he's muted.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Why are you?
You know how to unmute? You know how to unmute, Trevor?
He's at CIA headquarters.
Look on the far left, bottom left corner. It says mute.
I don't know.
There you go.
Alphabet Agency Trevor, welcome.
Okay. Good evening. Oh, good morning.
MI6, Trevor, the Caribbean. Mossad, PGP, interface.
I'll take that as a compliment coming from you, Bob.
Yeah, full of insults. So Trevor, you're usually meaner on the chat line, but it's a different game, so you're very cool. You're lowering your profile, your heat. You're stopping your hot medium effect by being sociable. Get the fuck out of there, Adler. Get Trevor back. All right, thank you. Yeah. Come on, Bob.
Bert's on the bed. You're all right. Bert went to bed. You're good. We got you.
I'm ready to shut up. Ooh.
You can see the fear in Trevor's eyes. He doesn't know what he's communicating.
No, we're just letting him know. We're just saying, no, the coast is clear. You're safe here. You're in a safe spot.
Jew. Don't do that.
agree with you. Don't do that. He will agree with you.
Yeah, Trevor can't be serious if he categorized me, Trevor. What the hell? I don't have a mean bone in my body. I don't have anything in my body. I'm
Trevor
should
do a pecking order of how of all the white people.
Yeah,
he's a total
Trevor.
Pushover. He's a total pushover.
Yeah.
Nothing weighs him down.
Yeah. So, Trevor, look at the gallery here and list the most racist to the least racist. You know, judge your faces.
That's my idea.
Yeah, that's Greg's idea. So, you know, just tell us who's the most racist.
Yuri is
the most
racist.
Yuri, a black guy. Yuri's
the
most racist.
Wait, I want to see.
Alyssa wants to see this. She wants to see who the racist.
Jeff's trying to get into it. Just trying to see what he can see.
Exactly.
Well,
you're correct, Trevor. Yuri's a racist. He's a bad background. We know a lot about Rip. We know a lot about
Well, Jeff's a Jew, so I feel like we're not going to be high up there.
Oh, damn. Well, I tell you what. You and Jeff Zucker, they're not doing so good today.
Who's next, Trevor? Who's next? Greg Duffel?
Which one's Greg?
The guy. You see
now? Catherine.
Pointer over her face.
No, this Mike O'Brien, he's definitely a racist.
Toronto person. Toronto's the most racist city in the world.
That's not true. That's not true.
Well. Yeah. What's the most racist city?
What are you saying, Greg? You enjoying yourself? You're laughing.
No, that was me laughing because didn't you say that it was Yuri who claimed that Toronto was the most racist city in the world?
I don't know. I can't remember what I just
thought
watched.
So, but then it turns out it was you who said that, and Yuri said that's not.
Oh
true.
Yeah, I said it. That's right. Yeah, yeah, a little confused there.
That's a
so
good one.
Now I'm asking. Trevor, what's the most racist city in the world? So he's going to answer.
Yeah.
Trevor?
Most racist city? Oh, Milan, Italy.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. See how quickly he knows?
What about the second one? What's number two?
Beijing.
London.
Yeah. So you see, Brian is racist. Okay. What about the lesbians, Christy and Lisa? Are they racist?
I don't know that.
Don't know that. You actually base knowledge? I thought you had X-ray eyes or something that you could tell immediately.
What? Lay down, boys.
Sadie is out of the wedding room.
I'm on my phone, you see, so I can't really see anybody from the judgment.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. They can get it, though. There ain't no joke about that. They get it. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I forgot about him. Yes, Ion is the most racist.
Yeah, that's true.
I can see.
capsule that has the salt, and you can decide whether you're going to put the salt in or not?
I think you can only get that kind of thing from Fortman and Mason, which is like a posh shop.
Oh, yeah? That used to be standard. Yeah. When I was over there in 1964, that was kind of standard.
Yeah. I think they've moved on.
You weren't there in
64,
Greg. You were there in 74.
They moved on, haven't they?
Yeah.
Greg, you were there in 74. Why were you there in 64? With your parents?
Oh, that was my first visit. In
1964.
That was when
Foghorn Leghorn
was president, Bob. That's right, great. That got Greg
into animation. Yeah. Foghorn Leghorn being president.
Yeah. I would have
preferred
Foghorn Leghorn being president.
Clinton laughing.
At least it would have been funny.
Look at everybody. I got
Okay. Greg, that's at 357, 358 if you want to look at it. No, Greg?
Mm-hmm.
Linus is there, Robert's asleep, Leon's asleep, Sarah's asleep, and it's just Greg.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Sarah. She's up. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want anything. Mm-hmm. And so Greg's mm-hmm. trying to talk, I think.
What?
I just said you're not responding. So did you hear that?
Yeah.
So you can look at that. That's at 3:57, 3 hours, 57 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's about when, just after that is when Trevor comes on. And you can see it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm finished. I'm going to go away. We're all going to go away. Look how late it is. 8 o'clock.
Yeah, I'm going to. I'm doing my jottle job.
What's that?
Don't tell him, Greg. Make him ask Ion. Because I did and he could already know, but... I wasn't allowed to get answers.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for Sarah to get over.
Yeah, fucking customer support still hasn't answered me. It's ridiculous. This is the craziest long wait I've ever had for something like that.
What? Why would they answer you? It's the middle of the night.
No, I already reached out to them. They haven't even gotten back to me, and I've just been sitting here for hours.
I don't know what they do on the hour on the... Let me just ask Carolyn. Just a second.
No, I already know what it is, Bob. They're going to be open until like 4 tomorrow or something.
Yeah, just a second.
Like 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay.
Yeah, I was doing my xylitol. I have to have it 5 minutes in my mouth. Before I go to bed. I didn't do it last night.
Yeah, have you read anything about the...
10 to 4. They're not there, Sarah, in the evening night.
Right. I know. I was being facetious. Greg, do you know anything about the cardiac risks that they're saying are related to xylitol?
No.
I can't get convincing information, but it was like a big pharma campaign a couple months ago in America. Like, they were just, no, xylitol's bad for your heart. But there's
really?
No, yeah, I can't get any, like, real information about that. So I'm guessing that overconsumption maybe does something, but I have no idea. So I was just curious.
I know I went to the dentist. And this is a few, you know, when I was in Victoria over a month ago. So it was just a little over a month ago. I went to the dentist and I had more cavities for some reason.
Well, what's xylitol, Greg?
Xylitol is a crystal, or it comes in a crystal form, and it's a sweetener. And it can be used for cooking, I guess. And it doesn't have all of the problems that are associated with that Splenda and all that kind of stuff. But
why is it in your mouth?
Okay, I'll tell you.
Because it neutralizes the pH balance. Like, it's, oh, this is so frustrating. Oh, sorry.
Well,
hold on.
For dentistry,
they discovered, but they were fooling around with this product back in Scandinavia.
I don't want to hear about it. I don't care.
No.
But is it for dental reasons?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, guys, I'm going away.
All right.
I'll leave it on if you guys want to talk for a while.
Okay, well, I'm going to go too. Catherine already came in and said I had to go to bed. So
I'm falling asleep over here.
Okay,
so.
All right. I think we've done our duty.
Yeah, I'm not going to have Ion. Ion's not going to break up the show like he did today much.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. All right.
It fucked up the show.
Good night, everybody.
Okay, good night.
Right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Brian.
Have a good one.
Yeah.